Tonight on the Download, Touche with Dave Lundy and Chris Veronis, Chicago Sun-Times Bears reporter Adam Johns, and live music in Studio 435 from jazz clarinetist Jason Stein. Now, here's your host, a man who is a jazz clarinetist in his mind, Justin Kaufman.
If I were going to have a clarinet, it would be a jazz clarinet, right? I mean, if you were so many ways to play a clarinet, but I would think that jazz would be the way that I would want to rock that out, right? I don't even know what the, like we were talking about last week, the reed. How do you purse your lips? It's not a thing for me. But if I knew what I was doing, I would definitely make it jazz. How about that? Does that make sense? Makes sense to me. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight here on beautiful 720 WGN, Michigan Avenue. Woo! Man, it's nice tonight. It's also getting darker, unfortunately. That's never good. We have this very peculiar way of celebrating and, I guess, observing the weather here in the Allstate Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue. Is that you can tell real quickly, especially being the 7 o'clock, because there's, you know, there'll be times in the summertime that we will be on the air in here till 8:30, 8:45, 9, 9:30, where you're like, wow, it's still light out. And then you get to nights like tonight where you get to about 7:15, and you can see it start to fade out. Pretty soon it'll be the dead of winter, and it'll be dark before we walk in here. I like to cheer people up on Mondays. That's what I like to do. I like to talk about the weather, and then I also like to talk about the Bears. I'm a cheery, optimistic guy. We will talk Chicago Bears. Our Monday evening quarterback segment begins tonight. The inaugural roll. Adam Johns in studio from the Chicago Sun-Times. He covers the Bears, and he does so very well. And we will be talking about what happened yesterday, how the team went. But more importantly, Adam does a tremendous job. He and Adam Hogue do a great podcast for WGN Radio, Hogue and Johns. But I will say, their breakdown of the game is exactly what I want as a fan. I want to know who's making mistakes when a safety isn't over the top and a tight end for the Atlanta Falcons stumbles for 88 yards. I want to know why we can't punch the ball in from the 5-yard line. Who's making the mistakes? As Anna said, oh, well, they all dropped the ball. Well, maybe. But possibly, if you look at Adam Johns' Twitter feed right now, it's a little bit more complicated, especially when the film comes out. And you start to see that the decision-making at the quarterback position is suspect. When you're supposed to get rid of the ball, who you're supposed to give the ball to, how much time you have, and you have to sort of, your clock goes off on when you're supposed to get rid of the ball. All those things in question, and we'll talk about it tonight with you, as well as Adam Johns, 312-981-7200. Also, we can talk about, I love the beginning of the game. They do the national anthem, right? They show it on the first week. They show the national. Usually, they don't show the national anthem for a noon game at Fox, right? And then what will happen is they will tell you who they consider to be the stars of your team by who they do the close-ups on with the hand over the heart singing along. So for us, it was Mike Glennon got a shot. Jordan Howard got two. Mitchell Trubisky got one, and then Mike Ditka got like five. Some sing-along parts for Mike Ditka. So that tells you what Fox thinks of the Bears right now. The star is still Mike Ditka. It's like everyone's in the shadow of Ditka. Oh, Ditka's there? Just, you know what, let's see if he can get on the field. If we can get him on, if we can put two cameras on that guy at all times. Also tonight, coming up after the 7:30 news, Dave Lundy will be here. Chris Veronis in for Chris Roebling. We'll do Touche. Talk about Steve Bannon, 60 Minutes. Also, what is, as he says, if President Trump gets a chance to build the wall that he wants to build, it'll be a landslide victory in 2020 for Trump. Says it's all about the wall. Interesting, huh? We'll talk with Dave and Chris, see if they agree. We'll also talk about some of the other big issues in politics, including climate change, of course, what happened down with Hurricane Irma. And then coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Matt Kerouac's going to join us for Industry Night, the author of the book Unique Chicago Eats and Eateries. We'll tell us about what we should be looking out for when it comes to Chicago restaurants. And 10 o'clock tonight, like we mentioned, Jason Stein from the Jason Stein Quartet. Bass jazz. Bass clarinet. Ooh, I'm excited. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leanne. Production provided by man Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, it's The Download here on 720 WGN Radio. All right, let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. Cook County Commissioner Richard Boykin announced today he'll be introducing a repeal measure at the Cook County Board on Wednesday for the sweetened beverage tax. And he wants to vote on it quickly, presumably because either A, he has the votes, or B, he wants to get everybody on the record so he can run against every single commissioner next time around. Boykin has been an outspoken critic of President Preckwinkle's tax, but Preckwinkle has pointed out that Boykin knew this was coming, and instead he's just using this as a political popularity contest, which if you're going to enter a political popularity contest, not a bad topic to hang your hat on. I believe that that sweetened beverage shouldn't be taxed. And then everybody cheers, right? If President Preckwinkle's a good president, though, she'll just talk about honorary street signs or ordering new high-back leather chairs for the duration of the meeting. Boykin will never get a chance to talk. Boom, adjourned. Next month, maybe? Okay. And then she sneaks back into her office and she just guzzles a 3-liter of Cherry Coke, punctuated with an evil presidential laugh. Goop, 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 goop. That's what I assume she's doing back there. She's hoarding. She's hoarding all the pop for herself. Steve Bannon's talking, and I guess we're listening. He said if Trump gets his wall, he'll win a landslide in 2020. He also said he's plotting Republican primary challenges, and the Comey firing was bad. So there you go. I just helped you out. You don't have to watch 60 Minutes. Clear it from your DVR so you can record more of the chew. Real great. It's like kind of like The View, but also they cook. It's great. Illinois Education Czar Beth Purvis, unofficial title. I don't think they call him czar in Illinois, announced today that she's going to be stepping down to move to a national not-for-profit. What's it mean for Illinois? I'm asking you. I don't know what she did or what effect it has on us, so let's go ahead and move on. The tech world's on vibrate right now after rumors of a new iPhone X announcement this week. Apple will be introducing a new phone, but some say don't get too excited because it's going to look a lot like a phone. What? We expect more at this point, right? I want my phone to be nothing like a phone. I want my new smartphone to be like a toaster. It takes phone calls, a text, pictures, and a toast bread. Nothing less, and I'm not liking it on Facebook. I mean, I love it in real life, but I'm not liking it on Facebook. The new DePaul Stadium by McCormick Place is almost ready to go, and to kick it off, the first concert will feature Bob Dylan. Finally, a stadium that can house Bob Dylan. Up to this point, he was just doing living room shows. I feel bad for the guy. Good to see he got his big break, right? Too bad Bob Dylan can't play point guard for the Blue Demons. Then people would stick around and watch basketball. Oh, snap. No, I didn't. That's my new catchphrase, by the way. No, I didn't. What do you think, Pete? You think that's good? Work on it? I can work on it? Okay, I'll work on it. In weather, we're settling into a nice little autumn thing here, huh? A little cloudy, but you can still hear the cicadas out, so that's a nice plus. Hurricane Irma now messing up Georgia and the Carolinas after hitting the state of Florida over the weekend. It's not even a hurricane. Did they change it now? Did they change it from hurricane? Did they say tropical storm Irma? They changed the. The governor of Florida said the Keys looked pretty bad, but he was surprised that it wasn't worse on the western side of the state. But still, tremendous flooding in parts of Florida, and the big issue is electricity. Harvey, Irma, and possibly Jose. Jose seems to be looping around in the Atlantic right now, but it could be problematic if it straightens out and heads right for the Carolinas. Jeez. Wow. We'll pay attention to it, of course. In sports, well, the Bears are back to being good at losing. They pick up where they left off last season, lose a game they should have won. The Bears had the ball first and goal at the end of the game and couldn't punch it in, losing to the Falcons. Highlights from the game? The pregame flyover was a stealth bomber. It's kind of cool. I wonder if there was like an actual order for jets and they're like, you know, we can't spare them, you know, North Korea stuff. Like, we can't. How about a stealth bomber? We don't use those anymore. Drones took their place. We got all the real highlights coming up here at 8 o'clock with Adam Johns. National media today trotting out the "why is Mike Glennon even playing" columns after his performance was scrutinized. Lots of checkdowns and a fourth down sack to lose it. If the season's going to go this way, why not just start Mitchell Trubisky? Also, wide receiver Kevin White caught what? Two balls? Maybe one? He's in the news today because he fractured his collarbone. He's on the IR for the third season in a row. Bears won't admit it, but he's probably out for the entire season. So that means the Bears' number one receiver right now is Kendall Wright? Or is it Josh Bellamy? Time to bring Tanner Gentry up from the practice squad. And Dennis Gentry, if he's still around. Right? Good old 29. But Tariq Cohen's 29. What are you going to do? Tariq Cohen, 5'6", running back with a nickname the Human Joystick, showed some serious playmaking ability with shifty runs, catches out of the backfield, power runs, punt returns, deep routes. The Bears found a way to undo his great name by not having him in the game at the end, though. He was on the sidelines for the bulk of the final plays because no need for a guy who can make plays when you need to make a play. So there's that. And nobody sat during the anthem for the Bears? Are we not one of those teams? We're going to let Oakland and Seattle have all that? Chicago's not going to have any of that? We don't have any politically conscious players? I'm just a little disappointed. Not because I care one way or the other politically. I just, like one guy to sit. Just one guy. Could be a backup guy. Could be a special teams guy. And another guy to stand next to him with his hand on his shoulder. That's what I want from my football team. In baseball, do we have to talk about baseball? Oh, we were gloating that the Cubs are going to cruise through September. I sat here last week with Panionovich talking playoff matchups. Yosh Kawana, time to cover the lockers with the plastic, huh? But then the Brewers came to Wrigley and swept the Cubs like a street sweeper rolling down Clark Street. Out of the way! The Cubs really didn't show much this week, and now only have a 2-game lead over the Brewers and the Cardinals, who swept the Pirates. Do I have to mention again that the Cubs end the season with two four-game series against both the Cardinals and the Brewers on the road? So the Cubs need to start winning. Luckily, they got the Mets sort of be their practice squad. But who knows? The Sox, they're so dumb. They're fighting against the Giants for one of the worst records in baseball, so which would mean a higher draft pick next year. So what do? They beat up on the Giants. The Giants have now moved ahead of the Sox for the number two pick. The Phillies have the number one. But come on, Sox. Tank if you're going to tank. Carson Fulmer did get his first win, so that's good. Keep him up, will you? You got Giolito, Lopez, and Fulmer for the rest of the season, playoff style. Just three in the rotation. If you didn't know, ace Carlos Rodon out for the season with an arm issue. Pretty short season. I mean, he didn't really start till the All-Star break. Not great. Not great for the guy who's supposed to be your ace. Yeesh. This weekend, the Blackhawks start training camp. Time to get the bad taste of how last year ended out of your mouth. The Blackhawks spent the offseason bringing back some hometown heroes, so I'm super excited to get this going. Training camp starts this weekend. And finally, a new report says that soon sex robots, apparently that's a thing, sex robots, are evolving at such a rate that they will be capable of murder in due time. Yikes. Unless that's your thing. I don't know. I guess we all should be ready and equipped with a safe word. Mine, Alt-Control-Delete. Alt-Control-Delete, Alt-Control-Delete. That's the carryout for September 11, 2017. Hey, if you're looking for a quick meal, might I recommend the chips and guac? We made it over the weekend, so it'll last all week. Don't worry about the discoloring. That just means it's high-end. All right. Coming up, Touche. Dave Lundy and Chris Varonis here. Talk politics. Get us up to speed on what's going to happen in Congress this week. All that coming up here on The Download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. I need to take a little shot at the Minnesota Vikings right now. They are the first of two games tonight, Monday Night Football. They're up in Minnesota taking on the Saints. On their huge jumbotron where the Vikings play, It had the Vikings logo, and it said, quiet, offense is working.
God, I hate that.
What are you kidding
that?
Me? Are
you got to like, tell
like
a fan
the, like the
yeah.
Vikings fans need to, I think they get it.
You know, today I'm in the middle of a dry. I got to go to the dry cleaner, And that's a thing I got to do. But I just pulled out a shirt and a combination that is essentially the Vikings colors. So if anyone, like, it's a purple and a yellow, and there's a little bit of blue in there. So if anyone is watching on the webcam or walking by, they're going to be like, oh, hey, Kaufman's Vikings are playing tonight. For the record, I do not like the Vikings.
No. But I'm just saying.
You're right. We're working.
Yeah.
Coffin, shh, guys.
No, it's a good thing they told us. We've only had NFL football up here for generations.
And they're outside, too, now, aren't they?
Are they?
Yeah.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
It is time for Touche here on the download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio tonight. Dave Lundy and Chris Veronis. Chris Veronis in for Chris Roebling.
They're playing our song, Justin. They're playing our song. I've missed that song.
I know. It's been a month. At least a month here. It's good to have you guys back in studio. Good to see you, Chris.
I feel like
good
the French. We took a month off.
It was a siesta.
A long siesta.
All right. So let's get the boxing gloves tied up here and let's get at it. I mean, right now, it seems like the Democrats have almost kind of they've had a great week in the sense that they got to negotiate with the president. But let's start with Steve Bannon, who essentially last night and in the news today has decided it's war against his own party, against the Republicans.
Yeah, the watching Bannon was, I don't want to say fun because it's more like painful. Bannon's declaring war on the Republican Party. He's declaring war on the establishment. He said the establishment declared war on Donald Trump the moment he won the election. And he said the Republican establishment. He called out Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and said that that Mitch McConnell specifically asked him to drop the talk about draining the swamp. So and therein lies the problem for me. I don't believe anything Steve Bannon ever says. Yeah. So.
Wow. We agree on the first count.
No.
On the first count. I don't believe what he says either, Dave. And I'm also one who thinks that Steve Bannon's bark is worse than his bite. I mean, this guy was made into be Godzilla on January 20th and even before. I will take Steve Bannon seriously if he can pick off a sitting member.
Well, he says he wants to do that, right?
Until that happens, all bark and no bite. But you know who this is really a problem for deep down is Donald Trump. Because if you're whittling away your majority in the Senate, especially in the House, because that's really becoming more and more in play, how would you like articles of impeachment when Nancy Pelosi becomes Speaker of the House? So if I was Donald Trump, I would
stop the rhetoric.
What's it mean?
I mean, when he says he wants to do a Republican or he wants to take down the quote unquote swamp and he wants to run campaigns, this is Bannon talking, in the primary. I mean, is he really going after replacing those Republicans with more Trump, like a different political party, a more Trump-like political party?
Well, this is part of the problem because Donald Trump has gone after moderate Republicans, and he's gone after, actually somebody calculated, he's gone after 20% of his party. He's called out 20% of his party, which is still more than he's ever done to Vladimir Putin, I might add. But he's only got a 2-seat majority in the Senate. So if he goes after Jeff Flake, which he said he's going to run a primary opponent against him, and I think they've got one identified. And if he goes after, I forget who the other guys he's planning to go after, but he's going after all these moderate Republicans and wants to take them out at the exact moment he's abandoning the Republicans himself. So, and that was one of the questions that Charlie Rose asked to Steve Bannon. He was like, well, but aren't you going after the people that you're going to need to protect the president? And Bannon's answer was,
well, doesn't Bannon think that not only will he win a primary campaign, but that would be a no-brainer to beat a Democrat in that same area? So, I mean, he is looking to reshape with more allies in the so-called quote-unquote swamp.
The so-called quote-unquote swamp. And again, I Bannon to me is all bluster. And he, in a sense, he really belongs at Breitbart because that's what he does best is just belch out venom. And, you know, to put this in context, you know, because I mean, this is worrisome, I think. You just don't want this fire on the right if you're Ryan or McConnell. But, you know, to put this in context, Republicans have something like a 6-to-1 fundraising advantage over Democrats. So, you know, if I were Democrats, I would be really concerned about who's giving.
Dave, let me ask you. I mean, you hear the stats like that, and you know, it's been just a couple of years since there was a thought that Democrats had the advantage in the political landscape of the United States. But then you hear Chris here say 6-to-1 fundraising. The president has turned the tide. More and more of this country is red than it is blue. Is there a crisis in confidence when it comes to the Democrats in this country?
Well, the Democrats have – I mean, it's so funny because these big macro narratives tend to get written based upon one person's election, and that's the presidency. And in this case, we, of course, had Hillary Clinton being defeated by Hillary Clinton. And the result was Donald Trump won, and that is my position. I'm sticking to it. Hillary beat herself, no matter what she says in this poor me book of hers. And then we take that and we say, oh my God, and therefore. But the reality is, you could look at not just the Hillary question, but the voter suppression stuff has turned out to be really, really, really effective. I'm sorry, they're numbers, Chris. And I know Republicans don't like numbers these days and data, but the fact is the Republican voter suppression techniques have deprived hundreds of thousands of voters in many states and millions and millions of voters.
Republicans on the other side are saying this.
I've known you for a long time, Dave, and I've never asked you for anything.
Yeah.
But please.
Yes?
Renominate Hillary Clinton. just for the good of the country. She needs another chance.
Please.
Third time's the charm.
No, we're going to go with Bernie Sanders this time because octogenarians are the wave of the future.
I mean, what is the future for the Democratic Party? Because, I mean, I feel like there's no one. David Axelrod was on stage right in the area just last week saying there's really
no farm team.
There's no farm team. There's no infrastructure for Democrats to make waves or make any inroads in 2018. I mean, where are they as a party? As you look, Dave, you've been a diehard Democrat for years. Where are they coming up on the 2018 midterms?
We're in trouble. I mean, look, the trouble we're in for 2018 is that we won't be able to take full advantage of what's being made available to us by Donald Trump. And I think that it would have been a super long shot to take over the House. It would be an even longer shot to take over the Senate because of the number of seats that we have to defend versus the number of seats that Republicans have to defend. So the fact that when you have Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer coming up with slogans like a better deal, it drives people like, you know, me up a bloody wall.
Think about what Dave just said.
No, don't. Okay.
Do we have a rewind?
Can we talk about Josh
here?
Bellamy dropping the pass in the end zone last night?
Justin, we got to rewind that.
Can we switch this
to
politics?
Can't take advantage
sports?
Of what Donald Trump said. I'm astounded. You can't win one congressional race. I mean, things are really, really bad for Democrats if you can't convert on Trump.
We're going to convert a bunch of seats. We're just not going to convert as much as we would otherwise.
Dave Lundy, Chris Varonis in studio. Touche. We are talking about national politics. When we come back, we haven't had a chance to talk DACA. Let's talk that. And let's also other things we could talk about, including climate change, as we saw political
it's
football.
No climate change.
This idea that climate change is not the right time to talk about it when the hurricane's coming through, and it became political when some were saying it shouldn't. It's all up in the air. So Chris Varonis, Dave Lundy, touche. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché.
It's Touché every Monday night here on The Download, 720 WGN. Chris Varonis and Dave Lundy in tonight as we discuss national politics. We go left, we go right. Let's talk about right in the middle, Donald Trump. Coming. Very interesting that he was able to work around the Republican Congress to come up with a debt ceiling deal and essentially with Democrat leadership, something that I think I would say that a lot of voters expected more of in the first year of Donald Trump, this idea that he wasn't going to have party affiliation, that he would work with whoever to get the deal done. This is the first time we've seen it. Before that, it was all Democrats' fault for this or Democrats' fault for that. This seemed to be one that put the Republicans on their heels, but at the same time, you know, it seemed to me like a political move for
Donald
Trump.
Else voters expected, Justin? that he'd make good deals. This was absolutely not a good deal. This was Chuck and Nancy, as he likes to call them. This
his
was
new
their
best
first
friends.
Offer, which he bit down hard on and swallowed. This is a stupid deal. Trump gets nothing for it. The issue is resurrected in 3 months' time when the game
the
plan
ceiling, right,
all
right.
along was to extend it a year or ideally 18
months.
Now,
why did he do it? What was the reason for doing it?
Because I think the meeting went long and he just got bored and wanted to get out of there and just said, okay, take it.
I've been guilty of that.
I don't. I actually have a different take on this. I think, though, in this case, I think it was absolutely the plan. He absolutely walked in there planning to go with Chuck and Nancy, his new best buddies.
He went into the meeting to cave. But here's why.
He went into the meeting because he's mad as hell at McConnell and Ryan. He thinks they failed him. He wants to that was a shot, in my opinion, that was a shot across the bow. That was a message
that will come back to him in 3 months.
That's correct. He's
going to re-inherit the issue in 3 months.
I didn't say it was a smart idea. Remember, he's impulsive. He operates out of anger. He operates out of frustration. And in my mind, when I saw that, the second I did, I'm like, oh, yeah, he just wanted to stick it to Ryan and didn't think about the fact that he bit down hard, as you said, on the first offer.
Well,
nobody. I mean, he's a real estate developer in New York. Nobody accepts the first offer.
Well, let me ask this. I mean, we'll go right into Doc on this. I mean, another move that politically, when you talk about the strategy of rescinding essentially what was an executive order from the previous administration to throw it back to Congress, and then for Congress to actually say, yeah, we all kind of agreed that we really want to do this. What is it a good strategy for the president to say, hey, Congress, take care of this immigration stuff, get it out of
my
lap?
Actually, the only way we're going to get past the only way we're going to do meaningful immigration reform is through Congress, period. We need a legislative solution. The system's broken. Both sides agree on that. And I think you could cobble together a majority to do a really good bill. Now, what Trump did, many would agree. I think many on my side would agree that you just can't do these executive actions. Even Obama himself said, I'm not going to do an executive action before he wound up doing it. What makes me scratch my head about the 6 month DACA delay is that Trump basically overruled his own attorney general, who said that this was unconstitutional, and wound up putting a bookend on this debate through a tweet that said, I'll revisit it, only when the media coverage was not trending his way, when he looked inhumane, when he looked cruel. And so I'm just left scratching my head. What are we doing on immigration reform when Trump wakes up from a nap and doesn't feel good and decides to take action on it?
Well, it's funny you said that, because I noticed that some of the coverage of the Chuck and Nancy deal, the first romance, was that it was great. And so there's stories about how Trump called Chuck and Nancy and said, hey, did you watch Fox News? Did you see the coverage? You guys are really getting some good press on this. It's like, dude, put the press aside. Just stop it. Stop yourself. And he
do
can't
you see
and
it,
won't.
Do you see it, Dave, from the Democratic side? Do you see it as a positive thing that the DACA delay and the idea that this is getting pushed back to Congress?
Well, first of all, I see it as a humanitarian catastrophe. I mean, I think that when you look at what is happening, look, there's no question that Obama was the deporter in chief, and that a lot of Democrats were very upset with him over it. But he didn't do some of the things that this Trump White House is doing. And what's interesting is during the campaign, Trump denied there was going to be a deportation force. And now we're hearing there's going to be a deportation force and that ICE is being empowered to have the largest deportations in U.S. history. And in fact,
Chris,
I was just reading it.
You know yourself, Dave, that net immigration is down. There's no more crossings happening right now.
There's
jobs to
not
be
the
had
point,
in Mexico.
Though.
But what's this deportation?
You're deporting
force
people who've never lived in Mexico as grown-ups. You're deporting kids. You're deporting people who have built lives
Possibly.
In this country.
Yeah, well, I'm all for the Dreamers.
The Dream Act passed overwhelmingly in the U.S. Senate.
Agreed. And something should be done. And yes. I've always said, even on this show, that the best friend Democrats have right now is Donald Trump.
Yes. But in this case, the best friend the Dreamers have is not Donald Trump. And I think that what happened when he said, oh, maybe I'll reconsider, is, as you said, he got some bad press.
Exactly.
And he hadn't thought through. And
exactly.
Again, this is the thing. You need a president to behave somewhat consistently, whether it's in foreign policy or domestic policy. This kind of like weird stuff. It's not jujitsu, because that implies there's some brilliant strategery here. It's just hyper. It's just like some kid who's hyper.
Before we break, and for tonight, let's talk about climate change. The politics of climate change came up there. CNN had asked Scott Pruitt, the EPA chief, about climate change, and he denied to talk about it, said it was offensive to talk about it while this was happening. But there's questions about whether or not we're being this what we saw with Hurricane Irma and what we've seen just with Hurricane Harvey is a precursor or something from climate change. And the question is, where does the administration stand? I mean, is this something that will become a political issue now that we've had these huge catastrophes in the last month?
Look, what happened with Harvey was exactly what was predicted in some of the climate models. I mean, not the 50 inches of rain, because that was so extreme. That was what they called a million-year event. But the problem is we're having these 100-year and 500-year events every year or two. And so
CNN was around a million years ago?
The right wing in this country who tries to deny climate change exists. Right. And Scott Pruitt is like the king of that. They're increasingly looking foolish by reality on the ground. And that's not just the reality of the hurricanes. It's the reality of the changing nature of the climate has weird effects all over the place. Chicago, I'm sorry, we didn't hit 90 this summer.
If you look at the statistical models for hurricanes going back to the mid-19th century, there's no upward trend. We have been in our hurricane drought for 12 years. There has not been a Category 3, 4, or 5 hurricane that's made landfall since 2005.
That is absolutely correct.
We are in a tornado drought, and you cannot show me one credible piece of evidence, statistical climate evidence, that shows causation.
Yes, I actually
no,
I can.
You can't.
Yes,
it's
I can.
Not out there.
There's lots out there.
We're going to call this segment "No, You Can't." Yes, I can. That's the new segment.
Yes,
here.
I can to infinity.
Yeah, to infinity. Dave Lundy, Times Chris Varonis, we'll pick this back up. You guys are back together next week, and I'd love to pick it back up on climate change. It would still be an issue. It's Touche every Monday night here on the Download. Chris, Dave, thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks.
We got the Chicago Bears Blues today. It's a Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time for a new segment here on the show called the Monday Evening Quarterback. It's a show that segment we'll do every Monday after the Bears game to give a better understanding of what we just saw in that 3 hours we spent on Sunday. Joining us tonight for the maiden voyage is Adam Johns. He is the Chicago Sun-Times beat reporter for the Chicago Bears. Also, Hogue and Johns, great podcast here at WGN. Adam, always a fan. And great to meet you and have you here,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, absolutely. A little overdue. It's great to be here.
Yeah, you know, it's one of these games, and you heard this over and over yesterday in the postgame, even with some of the postgame shows on television, saying, hey, you know, it's a loss, and you can't necessarily, you know, there's no trophies for second place in the NFL. But encouraging, a very encouraging win. After you've looked at the tape, is it still an encouraging loss?
I guess there can be such a thing, you know, from a fan's perspective. Yeah, there's a lot of encouraging signs. The defense, I thought they were going to be solid. The front seven, Keem Hicks, outstanding. The linebackers are coming along. I think you got better playmakers in the secondary. You're going to have a good running game. I thought Tariq Cohen, I thought he was going to do that. He's a secret weapon that's now not so secret. Very explosive player. But watching the tape, I just came away. Look, they should have won that game. The chances, the opportunities were there. Four tries from the five-yard line. Mm. Look, there's no moral victories in football. You played the defending NFC champions perfectly, and you had a win there. That, I mean, that should be a sour taste
and
in a sense.
And to be Frank, I mean, this was a big, even though last year we knew we were already in rebuilding mode when Jay Cutler was out and you had all the backup quarterbacks we were going through and we were, had pretty much the injuries on the field at the time. But some of those late games against the Titans and some other games later in the season where they were, the Bears played well enough to win and they found a way to lose.
Yeah.
And that was something that we thought would be corrected in the offseason. And here we are in week one with a chance, with, like you said, four shots to win the game from the 5-yard line, and we found a way to lose.
Yeah, my podcast partner, Adam Hoge, WGN Zone, he pointed out that it was very reminiscent of the Titans game, like you mentioned. Yeah. Matt Barkley was a quarterback there. He had two drop touchdowns in the end zone, Deontay Thompson, Josh Bellamy, who may or may not, it's arguable, could have had another one yesterday against the Falcons. But, yeah, look, John Fox's teams are going to be in games. This team is going to be in games the entire season. They're competitive. They're actually better than they were last year. I believe that. You need your playmakers. You need your quarterback to really be a difference maker in key moments in these games.
Well, let's talk about the quarterback position and also talk about the coaches. The way we'll break down tonight, 312-981-7200 if you want to get in the conversation. But we thought we would do this. We'll talk offense for the first half and defense for the second. But let's start with the coaching staff. John Fox overall, like you said, John Fox will keep you in games. Is that the style of this team to essentially play to almost Lovie Smith style, bend not break, and be within a score at the end of the game?
Right. Now, part of that's a lot of it. You know, they lack playmakers over the past couple of years for injury reasons, for not being on the roster reasons. But that's how he wants to play the game. And I thought they executed that plan in terms of their offensive philosophy, their defensive philosophy, to perfection. They kept things tight. They didn't let Matt Ryan and Julio Jones beat them. Vic Fangio kept things in front of them. There were some big plays, but they were off broken plays.
Yeah,
and
busts, right.
Look, the goal for the offense, specifically early on with Dow Loggins, and you know, John Fox has an influence on that offense as well, is ball security, ball control, keep that opposing offense off the field. If you got to check down your way down the field, you could do that. Just don't turn the ball over. Lennon did that.
That is, you think about it, that's why Jay Cutler wasn't the right fit for the Chicago Bears team and a John Fox-led team, is that far too often he was throwing picks to the linebackers when the game was on the line. This is a team that they hope they rectify that part. And the fact is, Mike Lennon's sole, I mean, the thing he's best at is making sure he protects the ball.
He did a great job with that. Sure, the check downs aren't exciting, but that's what they want him to do in those situations. But here's like my problem with that is you're going to be competitive this year. You're going to be very competitive this year. You just took the NFC champions down to the wire in your opener. You can win these games. You need your starting quarterback to show why he's the starting quarterback. He may have not been the reason they lost, but Mike Glennon could have been the reason they won against the Falcons.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And you think about the design of this team and some of those John Fox teams that he had in Carolina or even Denver. They played this way, but they also had a pretty stout defense that got to the ball, meaning a lot of turnovers. Once again, the Chicago defense, and we'll talk about it, played well, but they didn't get any turnovers. And this is something that is so head-scratcher for a Chicago Bears fan because
in the Lovie days.
Yeah, I mean, you think of Lovie Smith, you would expect two or three of those a game.
Yeah, you know, I thought Marcus Cooper had a chance for, God, even a pick six, it looked right there. He jumped the curl route by Julio Jones. Great play. The secondary is going to take some time. If anything, they were a concern going into the season, and just the lack of communication or the poor communication and some of the broken down plays, the 88-yard touchdown.
We'll get to that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's just, look, there's a reason why they overhauled the secondary. The big plays weren't there, but you can't let up big broken plays like that.
All right, so one of the big, and I want to get to the lines here. I want to get to Larry because this really, when you come to the coaching, we're evaluating the coaching, and I had some concerns early on just about why there was no challenge flag on the weird sort of third and two that turned into a first and 10 early in the game, which I don't know why you'd want to give Matt Ryan and Julio Jones any free first downs. There were some plays later. But the one issue when it comes to the coaching staff is substitutions and who's on the field at what time. Larry, what's your question, Larry?
Hey, good evening, gentlemen. You mentioned before that you want the quarterback to win. Well, your quarterback can only win if the coaches put him in a position to win, and they ripped the game right away from Gannon when they took out Cohen and put in What's his name?
Howard.
Howard's a great running back, but that guy can't catch a football with a bushel basket. He proved that last year. They always put Langford in last year to catch the ball.
Right.
Then they put him in there, and the guy just cannot catch a pass. Now, why didn't the offensive coordinator scream at Fox? Why didn't the running back coach scream? They're all just as culpable. They just kind of sat there with their collective heads up there where
right,
it doesn't belong.
Thanks, Larry. Well, that's a good question. Now, the question everybody's asking is Tariq Cohen has a monster game. He's proven he can play every single position. I mean, they're deep routes with this kid. And at the end of the game, they go with the standard package where Jordan Howard's in the game instead of Tariq Cohen.
Fox's reasoning today, actually, at Hallis Hall, was pass protection. Jordan Howard is obviously more experienced. He's physically bigger than Tariq Cohen, and that's one of the things. As explosive as he was in his debut, pass blocking.
He's a rookie. He's
5'6", 181 pounds. Benny Cunningham was the third down back early on in the game before he sprained his ankle because he can identify blitz pickups. He can be someone you can rely on. Now, he got hurt, and I don't want to make excuses for the Bears, but I think the circumstances called for change, at least in that situation. Tariq Cohen was your best playmaker throughout the day. Explosive, unstoppable in a lot of ways, stronger than he looks. Maybe give him a chance. Maybe just go with your gut in that situation. Go with the player
right.
who is performing like a star in that game and put him on the field in that game.
I mean,
moment.
It's one thing to not throw the ball to him, but to not have him in the game after he had such an impact on the Bears' offense. That definitely is a mark against the coaching staff. Adam John's in studio with us. It's Monday evening quarterback, 312-981-7200. We're breaking down the Bears' loss, week one loss to the Atlanta Falcons. When we come back, we got to talk Mike Glennon. Mike Glennon, who had a tremendous fourth quarter in bringing the Bears to a chance to win. Also, you know, when looking at the film, might be the reason they lost. Adam John's in studio. Stay with us.
The Bears.
It's a download here. It's Monday Evening Quarterback, our new segment. It breaks down what happened yesterday and the Chicago Bears lost to the Atlanta Falcons. Adam Johns in studio, the Chicago Sun-Times beat reporter for Chicago Bears. Also, Hogue and Johns, a great podcast here at WGN Plus. I love it. Listening today, you guys had a long conversation about the quarterback position, mm-hmm. and that is where we're at. Mike Glennon on, I get not even on paper, I don't think that's, but eyeballing Mike Glennon yesterday as a fan, you saw him in the fourth quarter lead the Bears down to a possible winning touchdown drive. You would assume that that would be enough to say Mike Glennon is our quarterback. But when you start looking at the film, you look at the numbers and the average per pass, the checkdowns, the immobility, the fourth down sack, and it doesn't do anything to quell this idea that we should be going with the rookie.
Yeah, look, I left Soldier Field feeling, oh, it was okay. It wasn't bad. Didn't blow this one for the Bears. Had an opportunity to win the game. He was good. He was okay. He was fine. Go back and look at the film. Oh, I don't know. I guess he was okay. He wasn't awful, but like there were opportunities to be had there. Now, I'm not saying I don't want to be overly critical of him.
Right.
He was good. It's his first start in years. Some context is needed. But he left plays out there. I honestly feel that way. People will blame Jordan Howard for the drop, and we should.
This was the second down play to Jordan Howard, and it looked like it was a touchdown. He dropped the ball at the 1 yard line.
Right. But you look at the velocity on that throw. There needs to be more zip on that pass. Maybe he gets the throw to him sooner, and he's able to go in with some momentum.
You put it on Twitter, and you showed the film that Jordan Howard is open coming out of the backfield in stride. If Glenn does what he did all game, check down, he's got a touchdown. For whatever reason, he hesitates. He waits to get over to Jordan Howard at the last minute. Howard's out of sync, kind of going backwards. The ball's not strong. I mean, again, nothing.
Yeah.
He should catch that ball. I'm not sure he should have caught that ball because we probably would have ran out of time at
right.
the 1 yard line. But the point being, there was a lot the quarterback did to make that more difficult than it should have been.
He's not his first read, but it's the game's on the line. You're the starting quarterback. Get through those reads fast. You're not surveying the entire field, you're surveying half the field like he did. Zach Miller, maybe Josh Bellamy. Jordan Howard, you were checking down the Jordan Howard all game. Why'd you wait to go to him that long in that key situation? Look, I don't want to come off like I'm ripping the guy. First start, a couple years, give him a shot.
Right.
I'm trying to give him a shot, but I think when you're paying a guy $16 million for one season and you're calling him the starter, you should hold him to a high standard. Fine is not good enough when wins are on the table.
And, well, I mean, you said it. You said it in the first segment, the idea that, you know, you're kind of on the field not to lose the game, but in this case, we needed you to win it, and that kind of worked against the Bears.
Yeah, and they're going to be in games. They're going to need Mike Glennon to be a playmaker, and you could criticize his receivers all you want. They're down Kevin White now with Cam Meredith. I mean, they are decimated at right. the receiver position, but this is where the playmaking ability of the quarterback comes in. This is where he can buy his receivers extra time to gain separation. This is where he's got to have some pocket awareness so that Josh Bellamy can gain a second of separation. It all works hand in hand. Look, his mobility, his pocket presence, and his decision-making, how fast he does it, were concerns when he was drafted. There were concerns when he was a rookie starter in Tampa, and I thought they were concerns against the Falcons in week one.
You saw it play out even in the first, second, and third quarter when Mike Glennon did have to get through his progressions and there was a little bit of pressure. You saw a lack of mobility in the way that you don't see as much. I mean, I was thinking old Peyton Manning. You know, like, I'm not yeah. talking Colts Peyton Manning. I'm talking 41-year-old Denver Broncos Peyton Manning.
Bad neck,
but
Peyton
he knew how to throw the ball right away. And it just the idea that the NFL and the speed of this game, which has just become so much more intense, to have a quarterback who, when the play breaks down, cannot move. I mean, he it's a slow quarterback. It's a little bit concerning for me as a Bears fan.
Yeah, what's the saying? Open in the NFL is very different. It's like that split degree of separation or that, you know, the defensive back getting caught out of position for like that split second. Open is so small yeah. in the NFL. And sometimes you need your quarterbacks to throw guys open, to put them in spots to succeed. And you need to be able to scan the field fast. Look, Peyton Manning, when they won the Super Bowl with the Broncos, did not have an arm whatsoever.
Right.
You know, and even at the tail end of his career, he was a statue back there. But the ability to scan the field, know your pre-snap recognitions, then go through your progressions fast made him special.
Yep.
Mike Glennon is one edge right now is experience and being able to see things better than Mitch Trubisky. But if he's going to be that slow with him in certain moments of the game, important moments of the game, why not, maybe? You know, you start to wonder if Trubisky
well,
can do something.
The national columns are out. I mean, it was surprising to me to go on CBS and see a huge picture of Mike Glennon and Mitch Trubisky and columnists there saying it's time for a change, essentially saying that if you're going to run this offense where you check down and you throw for 5 yards a pass, if your rookie quarterback can't understand that concept, he's a bust.
that
he shouldn't be, he can't be on the NFL field. So it's not like Dowell Loggins is out there doing crazy offensive schemes, Mike Martz type stuff that Mitchell Trubisky can't figure out. This was a pretty simple conservative game plan. Why can't the rookie get in and be able to execute?
Absolutely. And look, they'll point at the fourth quarter, the 163 yards that Mike Glennon threw for in the fourth quarter. It's impressive. It's an impressive number. But you watch the film again, and a lot of those completions, for whatever reason, Falcons are backing off. It's like they're daring Mike Glennon. Okay, you've been playing check down game the entire way. Beat us with it. Beat us with it. And they threw some pressures in there in certain situations. I know Mike Glennon had a big fourth down completion, but you know, if he's checking down, maybe he shouldn't be in that situation to begin with. You need to hold your quarterback to a higher standard, I think, when you're paying him $16 million and you have the number two overall pick on the bench.
You know, as we move to other parts of the offense, you know, obviously Tariq Cohen had a huge game. The human joystick becomes
chicken salad. That's my favorite one.
a tremendous, not only just first NFL game, but used like a Marshall Faulk. I mean, he was used in a way that he was pitches, sweeps, power runs, out of the backfield, wide receiver routes, a bomb.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I mean,
how about
special
that?
Teams, he's catching punts. I mean, I don't know how much this kid can take at 5'6 to be able to do 80% of the Bears' offense, but tremendous, at least in that regard. I have to say, the Bears' offensive coordinator, he knew he had a weapon, and he used him full on.
Absolutely. Very creative. Used his speed to...
That would have been a touchdown if Mike Glennon would have thrown the ball to the spot he was supposed to throw that bomb to.
Oh, you know, you got to give the defender credit. Those guys get paid, too. To be, God, what's the name of it? Devontae Campbell. I'm probably thinking of the wrong guy. Yes.
Yeah, right.
Turn and ran. You got a forearm on the ball. Wasn't even turned around. You think, you know, with Cohen with some more experience, we'll probably stop and lunge himself into the defender to gain,
to get
you know, the
pass interference.
But that
comes
with time.
The ball was underthrown a little bit.
Yeah, and he... you know, Glennon did make some good throws. Like the three Cohen wide open touchdown pass. You know, that's an inexplicable busted coverage by the Falcons, you know, but Glennon went through his reads and found them. So there's good moments, but yeah, what a weapon Tariq Cohen's going to be. Exciting.
Think, I mean, I would say possible NFC player of the week in the way that he was everything for the Bears. Do defenses now figure that out? I mean, is this a one and done kind of thing for Tariq Cohen, or does he have the skills to be able to beat a prepared defense?
Well, you need to adjust your own game plan. Then there was a play that Kevin White was in the slot and Tariq Cohen was outside of him. Right, they're going to line them up everywhere.
Awesome.
And to me, like, it was like a sign of respect. I think the Falcons checked the zone defense, but instead of the linebacker typically chasing the running back out like they usually do and matching them up that way, the linebacker stayed in on Kevin White and the cornerback moved to Tariq Cohen.
So they're already aware of him.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Now, they did have that blown coverage later, but yeah, you're going to have to be creative with him. You may have to get him on the field with Howard more, but he's your best offensive weapon. He's dynamic.
What I mean, we didn't talk about, I think, one of the best plays of the day, and it hasn't gotten much coverage today, but the Wildcat, the Bears on the goal line for their first score, they take Glennon out to the wide receiver position. They snap the ball to Tariq Cohen. He hands it off to Jordan Howard. Touchdown.
Yeah.
I mean, that is something you just don't think about when you think of the Chicago Bears.
Oh, yeah,
offense.
The Falcons had no film on that. Absolutely. Mike Glennon is your outside lead blocker, you know, although he kind of just good for him for not, you know, putting his body in harm's way. I'm surprised the cornerback didn't take a good lick on him, but yeah, the Falcons had no sense of that was coming. There's no preparation. There's no game tape on that.
That's amazing. All right, 312-981-7200. Here's what we do. We want to talk about the wide receivers because that was a big issue. Kevin White, broken collarbone. What is it? A scapula?
Yeah, a shoulder blade.
He's on the IR. They kind of avoided the idea of whether or not he's out for the year in the way that he might be able to return if it doesn't need surgery, things of that nature. And then we'll talk also about the Bears defense, which took on the number one all-world offense.
And held their own.
And held their own, except for one play that unfortunately sums up the Chicago Bears. 312-981-7200. Adam Johns in studio. It's Monday evening quarterback here on 720 WGN. Stay with us.
Here's a pitch. Tariq Cohen in the game. Tries a reverse field. Gets away from Reed. Cohen sprinting. Oh, boy. Tariq Cohen in Falcons territory. What a run. I think Bears fans have a new favorite player. That's 46 yards to Tariq Cohen. Jordan Howard and Tariq Cohen in the game at the same time in the backfield now. And look at this. We're going to go a little wildcat action. Glennon's a wide receiver at the bottom of your screen. Here's Cohen. They're going to give to Howard. Running right. Jordan Howard. Diving. Touchdown.
That was definitely a highlight. It's Monday evening quarterback here on the download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Adam Johnson, studio with us. Chicago Sun-Times Bears beat reporter, also one half of Jones, or Hogan Johns, the great podcast that you can hear here at WGN+. You know, that play right there was the creativity we're looking for. It was very interesting to see around the NFL, even tonight, the Saints and Vikings. It looks like the Vikings handily taking care of the Saints, but throwing the ball around. The Jordy Nelson yesterday, even with the vaunted Seattle defense, being able to catch one over the top for a touchdown. The rookie Kenny Golladay.
From St. Rita.
Yeah, NIU product, yeah. Right? Two touchdowns. And then you get to Chicago, where we already are without our number one and Cam Meredith out for the year. Kevin White, everyone's looking for something out of him. He dropped a slant pass, and then we see what looks to be a 1 yard gain. He comes off the sideline, goes into the little blue tent, and that's it.
Yeah, it took a big hit from, I think it was the Tack McKinley, the high-round pick of the Falcons. And look, I feel bad for Kevin White. How can you not? Look,
it's terrible.
I get that some fans are seventh-round pick, he's a bust. You know, these are freakish injuries. I know football, it's a violent sport. Injuries happen, but these aren't pulled hamstrings.
Three in a row. I mean, to three seasons in a row, it's completely unpredictable.
Yes.
And it's just a bad, bad case of luck for this kid.
Right. A very likable player in that locker room. His teammates, the organization, really love this kid. Just an awful break. But, yeah, in terms of now bodies on the field, you're down your number one. You're down your number two. Marcus Wheaton's supposed to be your number three, but he hasn't practiced really in full since OTAs.
Broke his pinky, right?
Broke his pinky, emergency appendectomy. You need him. Now he's your number one. Kendall Wright's now your number two.
Well, Kenny Golladay is a good example of there was some criticism or concern around draft time that the Bears didn't go out and get a wide receiver with their third round, fourth round, fifth round pick, whatever it might be. Didn't bring any – I mean, they went through the route of free agency to bring some guys in. But here we are in a position where, yeah, as you said, I mean, Marcus Wheaton, who hasn't seen the field yet, Kendall Wright, who, you know, is a serviceable slot receiver, and then – here we go to the same guys who were on the field last year at the end of the season, the Josh Bellamy's and the Deontay Thompson's and these guys that I'm not sure are who Bears fans want to be seeing touching the ball in the fourth quarter with seven seconds to play on the goal line.
I thought the Bears took too long to establish one right, didn't have any catches until the fourth quarter. What's going on? If you need underneath options, you would think Kendall Wright, especially on check down plays and all sorts of quick read throws, all that stuff. Kendall Wright, awesome option for that. Didn't have a catch in the fourth quarter. Your tight end, your big free agent signing, Deion Sims. Why was his first catch the last play of the third quarter? Mike Glennon's only completion in that quarter, by the way. Why?
Interesting.
Why is he? Why did it take so long to get him going? These are supposed to be your big free agent additions.
Right.
Provide your offense a spark, some versatility. Why aren't they options? Like, why isn't Deion Sims more of an option from the fourth and five? You know, or for the four plays on the 5-yard line in the final minute.
Yeah. Right.
Where's Adam Shaheen, the second round pick?
I want to ask you about that. He didn't show up at all in the game. Did he play?
I think 8 offensive plays. I get they're bringing him along slowly. His blocking, his needed work. He simply just didn't do it in Division II Ashland. He was just bigger than everybody. Didn't have to be fundamentally sound. So it's taking him some time. But you think, at least in those situations, when you get in tight, here's a guy who's 6'6", 271 pounds. Give him a chance. He's got those soft hands. That's why he's a second-round pick.
Right.
That's why everybody had a high round grade on him. Give him an opportunity.
That's fascinating, too, and would be the guy that you'd want to see in the game with at the 5-yard line to just turn around.
They
kind of tried that play with Zach Miller, and it didn't go that route. But if that's Adam Shaheen, it might be a different story.
Right, let him box you out. He's got the basketball experience.
Right.
He did it in glimpses early on in camp and early on in OTAs, and then he kind of tailed off because I think the Bears wanted him to focus on other things, but the athleticism is there. Give the kid an opportunity. I mean, those are big moments. Get your big tight end a chance to make a big play.
All right. We somehow, Adam, have talked only offense on the Bears, which is blasphemy.
Quarterbacks will do that.
Blasphemy. All right. So let's talk about the defensive side of the ball. As we kind of teased out before the news, the Chicago Bears defense held their own against the Atlanta Falcons, noted to be one of the best, if not the best, high-powered offenses in the NFL. This was not how we thought things were going to go at the beginning of the game, but the Bears defense, especially that front seven, shut it down, and they come away with the game ball if anybody does.
They own the line of scrimmage, except for maybe that one touchdown run by Tevin Coleman. They really shut down the running game. They made the Falcons one-dimensional. Even as much as the Falcons tried to be balanced, you know, it just wasn't going anywhere. Sam Acho, I thought, was outstanding versus the run. Right. A very underrated player, especially in those situations.
Can I ask you, you cover football. I don't understand how the Atlanta Falcons, who had such success in the Super Bowl and other places, and they're without it, they have a different coordinator.
Yep.
But they seem to be very pedestrian in the way that they approach this game. A lot of straight-ahead runs, a lot of trying to establish the run. Even late in the third quarter, trying to establish the run. When you have Matt Ryan, Julio Jones, a beleaguered Bears secondary, I was surprised to see them in some of the play calling in crucial situations.
I think losing Kyle Shanahan to the 49ers, of course there's going to be some differences in play call rhythm. You know, the offensive coordinators talk about rhythm as play callers, so I think that's a factor. But I want to give Vic Fangio's unit and his game plan and his players a lot of credit. If it wasn't for that awful blown coverage, and there was another one in that fourth quarter as well. You know, Austin Hooper had that 88-yarder.
Yeah.
He had a 40-yarder later, you know, on another
wide open,
another couple broken tackles, ran right through Kyle Fuller, ran right through Eddie Jackson. I mean, that was a 3rd-and-10 play. It gave them a field goal eventually, and that's why they had to.
Yeah.
The Bears had to score a touchdown in the final minutes there. So I thought Vic Fangio's defense was very respectable.
What was it? I mean, was it just the winning in the line of scrimmage? I mean, did they dial up blitzes? What was the Fangio approach to the Atlanta Falcons?
Well, I think he knew he had the mismatches he wanted. I mean, Eddie Goldman, I feel bad for the right guard. I can't I don't remember his name. He probably doesn't want me to remember his name right now. Akeem Hicks abused him. It was bad. the Falcons guard, you know, he's not going to like his film review today and tomorrow and all that stuff. So good thing we don't remember his name because right. he doesn't need that right now. They own the line of scrimmage. I thought Leonard Floyd was – people ask why, you know, where was he as a pass rusher? He was used in coverage a lot. I think that's because just the speed the Falcons throw at you.
And
with
he
didn't
play late in the game. Finally, he showed up on a stop.
A tackle for loss. He had one, yeah.
But, I mean, you're right. I mean, he was and more importantly, let's talk about the other side. Pernell McPhee, who we heard, what, a week ago, that he's in the best shape of his life and he made the 53-man roster. We thought we'd see him making plays on opening day. What was the story on McPhee?
I think he had 4 snaps, maybe 6. I believe it's 4, but not a lot. He was on the field. If you can recall, Matt Ryan had that scramble on got like a second and long, and he got the first down in a run where he scrambled away. Pernell McPhee was in on that play. Look, I knew he was going to be on a play count, pitch count, as they call it. 4? I didn't think it was going to be 4.
It's surprising. I mean, it says it sends a different message in what they're saying in the press conference. If your star linebacker is only playing 4 and he's in the best shape of his life.
Right, should be able to be relatively productive in that situation. Clearly, he's not ready. I thought Willie Young probably could have had a little bit better of a performance, but he was primarily used in passing situations.
His big move is the flop, the Hollywood flop. I'm being held.
He got one of them.
He tried it again when he got beat on the edge for the touchdown.
Right.
And they dropped
him in coverage in certain situations. So Fangio's flexible. Look, I think Willie Young's a very nice player. I think you'll see better from Leonard Floyd, but that front 7 is definitely a strength of the Bears. I think Danny Trevathan will get better. Even if Jarrell Freeman is lost for a bit of time because of his concussion and his chest injury, Nick Kwiatkowski, who I think really should have pushed Trevathan more for that starting job, I think he's a very nice player in making.
So let's talk about the secondary, because overall, missed tackles, but, I mean, they also did a good job. And, I mean, you mentioned Marcus Cooper, his first game as a Chicago Bear, almost jumped around for a pick 6. Quentin Demps was around the ball most of the game. Yeah. I mean, even Kyle Fuller, you saw him early in the game with some pass deflection. So
statement season.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, if you just looked at it as a casual fan, you'd be like, besides that broken play and the tight end and the later broken play, they did a good job holding the Atlanta Falcons' high-powered offense.
I think
looking at the tape.
Right. I think Julio Jones had 4 catches for 66 yards. That's a win. That's a big win for the Bears secondary. Now, they played a lot of zone certain times, and Matt Ryan was able to pick him apart and move the ball down the field. But it's going to take some time for chemistry to develop there, and they know it. Clearly, you look at the lack of communication on that awful.
Let's do it. Yeah. Let's talk about that play.
Yes.
So everybody who watched it, especially from even a casual fan, saw a lot of communication and pointing and yelling and players kind of saying, you're supposed to be there. Where am I supposed to be before that ball was snapped?
Right.
Usually that means timeout. We're not lined up right. The Bears don't do it. They gamble. What happened?
Yeah. I thought they should have called a timeout, and they had called a timeout earlier on in the game where they had a late personnel change, so they kind of blew one in the second half.
They didn't want to lose it, right.
Yeah, so they didn't want to use another one. John Fox said they had the right call in. It was just a matter of them executing it. But clearly, they may have had the right call in, but guys were hearing different calls. You can't leave a tight end, a high-round pick tight end, that wide open. The linebackers should have followed him up the seam, should have trailed him. Demps has to be over in the middle. And I get what Demps is thinking. You get Julio Jones to your right.
One-on-one on the left. Right?
Matt Ryan is staring him down. Now, sometimes good quarterbacks will do that. You know, they'll move safeties with their eyes and stuff like that. So it happened there. He got played by Matt Ryan a little bit. But it's just, I feel like we've talked about this so many times, so many seasons. Last year.
Oh, my gosh.
There was mistakes.
I mean, you go back to I hate to say it, different coaches, different coordinators, but the Super Bowl, Daniel Manning's in the wrong spot where the Colts score a touchdown. What was the year with Mark Trestman where Chris Conte was in the wrong spot?
And the Packers.
Yeah. I mean, the safety's in the wrong spot. That's a tradition in Bears football.
Yeah, it's maddening. It's frustrating when you see a guy, like he was almost sacked, too. The defensive line almost got the Matt Ryan, but again, going back to that point where you need your quarterback to make your plays.
He made a great play.
Bought himself some more time, saw the guy wide open in the middle of the field, and that's what you get. You know, that stiff arm, that was ruthless. Quentin Demps did not like film review today, but he's not alone. Again, that 40-yard reception he had later,
they
set up
the
field goal. Kyle Fuller ran right through Eddie Jackson. Not good.
I guess, you know, you cover the NFL, you know a lot of teams. I mean, I always make this argument saying, why does it always happen to the Bears? I mean, are you seeing the Vikings making safeties in the wrong spot or busted plays in Philadelphia? Like, I mean, is this just an NFL thing where plays come in fast and we just don't see the highlights because we're in Chicago? Or is it just always happen to the Bears?
Yeah, you know, they happen quite frequently. I just think the Bears are a unique case because they've had so much personnel change over the past three seasons under Ryan Pace. So they're expected, but they can't be expected to be that costly. Right. You're going to make mistakes. They're human beings out there, and it's a fast game. Things are moving all over the place. People are going to communicate messages wrong. You're going to read the wrong things. So their mistakes are going to happen in the back end. I just think when your margin for error is that slim and you're going to be in games, you cannot give plays like that away.
It felt like maybe that happened more often than we knew, but you had guys like Brian Urlacher and Lance Briggs and Charles Tillman who could make plays to cover up a busted –
right,
they're not going to get stiff-armed and a guy's going to rumble for another 50 yards.
And here's the thing, like, to go back to the quarterback point, good quarterbacks can make up for a lot of teams' woes. You know, they control the line of scrimmage more on the offensive side of the ball. They could be exciting, and they can make their own down-the-field throws and stuff like that. Like, when you have an outstanding quarterback, you know, the rest of those problems just seem so secondary and minute because this quarterback can make up for a lot of the other deficiencies on your roster.
You saw yesterday in the game with the Packers and the Seahawks, the touchdown to Jordy Nelson was an Aaron Rodgers recognizing that the Seahawks were trying to change personnel. He caught a guy running off the field. He realized it was a free play.
Oh,
yeah. He goes over the top. That's what you're talking about. That's a play. He makes a play there that other quarterbacks just can't.
But that's what starting quarterbacks should be expected to do. Carson Wentz had a great play like that yesterday. Again, we talked about Matt Ryan did it yesterday. Look, not everybody's going to be Aaron Rodgers, but if you're going to be a starting quarterback in this league, you have to make plays that make up for all the problems on your roster.
Adam Johns, the Chicago Sun-Times beat reporter for the Chicago Bears, and of course also Hogue and Johns, the podcast here at WGN Plus. Join us here for Monday Evening Quarterback, our new segment here on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200. 406 says, you know, is it the coaching issues when it comes to where these guys are supposed to be on the defensive side? You know, if safeties are in the wrong spot, is that a secondary coach's problem? Is that a defensive court? Like, who did the coaches have any? Are they culpable at all for the idea?
Well,
that
yeah,
these guys
I mean, yeah, I, everything kind of works hand in hand, but at the same time, they could have the most perfect call in. They could nail it, the right call. The player still has to execute
it, right?
And if the execution is poor, if you fall out of place or you misread and you cheat over to Julio Jones' side, you can pay for it. You got to know your reads. The coaches help, but they can't play for you.
Well, Adam, it's amazing we're talking about the idea of the dynamic play and the potential weapon of Julio Jones changes the game even though he's not making a play. That's what having a number one receiver means.
Yeah, right, right.
We may not know that in Chicago, but that's why the Quentin Demps is so worried about Julio Jones. He doesn't think about that there might be someone running right down the seam. The real quick on special teams, Connor Barth hits a big field goal. Tariq Cohen, this poor kid, turning punts, but he looked good.
Yeah,
I mean,
he
looked like he could break him. He had shades of Devin Hester there. I mean, a much improved special teams performance.
Yes, Pat O'Donnell, I thought, was outstanding. Had a couple pinned inside the 20. Other than the first kickoff, I thought Connor Barth was pretty exceptional and pretty good on his directional kicking on kickoffs. Tariq Cohen, it'll be interesting to see how much they use him on returns
once
going
they realize
forward.
What kind of value he
yes,
has.
Yes, I think he's already too valuable to, like, there'll be situations for it. You need a big play, you need to change the momentum of the game, throw him out there, but every single time, maybe give the kid a break.
I'm a big fan of the punt returner who actually can score a touchdown as opposed to the guy who can catch a ball. That's what the Bears have done in the last couple of years. They're like, get the guy who could just catch it.
Right, right. That's safe. Safer than sorry.
Yeah,
reliable.
We don't like that. Injuries. Play. Let's talk about this. You mentioned Jarrell Freeman, the starting linebacker. Didn't show up for media afterwards, and then they kind of, in a strange way, the Bears projected that he was in concussion protocol and kind of were protective of it, but today it comes out that he is in concussion protocol, could miss some time.
Yeah, and John Fox kind of hinted that the concussion may have played a role in that fourth quarter 88-yard Austin Hooper touchdown. Like, he just was out of sorts, and that's...
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's not good, you know, with the concussions and what everybody knows about them now. Just not a good look if that's the case. Somebody should have spotted it. Now, I know these guys want to play through this stuff. Maybe the symptoms showed up later, but still not a good look. Not good to hear that.
And he's the play caller, right? I mean, he's one of the guys who relays
gets everybody
it to everybody
in order.
Else.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Now, Danny Trevathan and Nick Kukowski can do it, but
right.
I mean, Jarrell Freeman.
He played well yesterday.
He's just an underrated. Yeah. Yeah. Very good player.
He's around the ball at all times.
Heart and soul player.
We saw Kevin White out for the year. Any other injuries that came out of yesterday's
game? Benny Cunningham. Again, he's your third down back. He's an option at punt returner if you want to spell Tariq Cohen. High ankle sprain. Those things can linger. I mean, Jeremy Langford had a high ankle sprain that required surgery by the end of the year. And
see where he's
now
at.
He's gone.
All right, let me ask you about two guys who didn't play yesterday. Kyle Long, who did not suit up for the Bears. Will he be back for the game in Tampa? And secondly, Prince Ukamura, who came in as supposed to be the number one corner, did not play as well.
Yeah, Kyle Long's thing is to hear them speak and wanting to, I mean, he's talking about wanting to feel like himself and seem real down on his luck. This is a guy who hasn't had a full padded practice since Bourbonnais. It's a long time, and he's starting a new position at left guard. You need to catch him up to speed. Heart and soul player like Jarrell Freeman, you need him at some point, but you need him for the long term. You can't risk further injury. It's a long season. Make sure that ankle is right. You're going to need him. But, yeah, it's pretty – you can feel down when you hear him be very down about his situation. Mm. So we'll see where he's at. And Prince Mukamara, they need him. They really do. I thought Marcus Cooper and Kyle Fuller were okay. Yeah. Kyle Fuller missed a couple tackles. I thought Cooper was more impressive than others. But you signed this guy to a $7 million contract. You need him to play.
Will he play? I mean, what's his ailment?
A sprained ankle. You know, and these things can linger. And he's a cornerback. He's going to have to plant, cut, and all sorts of things on that bad
foot. A lot being talked about that the next game for the Bears is in Tampa, of course, with Hurricane Irma. They didn't get hit as much as they could. They're probably still going to play the game there. That's going to be an emotional time for the players. And for Tampa, this will be their opening day. Is that good for the Bucs that they missed a day and they got some tape on the Bears and the Bears don't have it on the Bucs? Is it bad that they're rusty in the fact that they haven't been on the field yet?
I think it works both ways. They clearly got other things on their mind, more important things than football on their mind, just because they had an extra week to prepare for the Bears. It's not like they're all hanging out together and watching the Bears play the Falcons. I mean, they were dealing with their families, dealing with their properties, getting everything in order. They have bigger, more pressing, more important concerns, frankly, than a football game. But now, since we're talking about football, I actually think it favors the Bears. I think the momentum, the excitement that you have going into your opener, have that taken away from you. Then you're having to deal with the serious nature of this hurricane, you know, affecting your families and your friends and all that.
And all that being emotional psychology, the Tampa Bay Bucs are a playoff team. They Jameis Winston and that defense, they run around. This is not going to be an easy test.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see if the Bucs can turn on the switch. Yeah. It really will be. But I'm picking the Bears in this one. Early. Very early. That's what my gut is telling me.
Adam Johns, the beat reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, and covers the Bears, also does the Hogan Johns podcast here at WGN Plus, and does great coverage. I mean, just today on Twitter – seeing the film study and how people interact with you is great. Adam, I can't thank you enough for being our first guest on the Monday Evening Quarterback. Appreciate it.
It's fun. Let's do it again.
Third down and three. Ryan, pressure, in trouble. Lets it fly deep. Wide open is Austin Hooper. Now it's a foot race. Stiff arm against Stetz. Hooper is going to go. Touchdown. 88 yards.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time for Industry Night, our weekly segment that features the world of food and hospitality. Recently, we talked with Chef Diana Davila from Mia Takaya in Logan Square. And before that, we talked about the pop-up restaurant phenomenon. Tonight, we talk unique eats. Chicago writer Matt Kerouac has put together the definitive book on the Chicago culinary scene. It's called Unique Eats and Eateries of Chicago. In it, Matt profiles just under 100 restaurants, from the big hitters like Au Cheval in the West Loop to Calumet Fisheries in South Deering. Matt is a Chicago-based food writer who's worked for several publications, including Time Out, Daily Candy, and Zagat, and he's my guest tonight. Matt, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about this book. I find it fascinating because you've worked for so many different publications, and you've collected all this information on the Chicago culinary scene, information that could be cataloged on a website, but you've put it together in book form. Talk about this project. Where did it come from?
Yeah, well, after years of writing about food and restaurants in Chicago for different magazines and websites, meeting Reedy Press and just discussing the idea of putting a book together that would really provide a good cross-section of the city and the diverse restaurants that just fill up the different neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. It was a unique opportunity to delve a little bit further, or a lot further in this instance, into all those restaurants and talk about the chefs and the backstories that I don't really get to explore too in-depth websites.
And truthfully, if you're talking about all the websites that cover the Chicago scene, a lot of that's through reviews or features. I mean, this is really telling the story of a restaurant, encapsulating it, almost like an encyclopedia.
For sure. And that was the most exciting, privileged thing for me to do with this, because a lot of my writing nowadays, that's Chicago-based, is so centered on splashy openings and chef news here and there, which is so much, so it kind of dominates. So this was really fun and exciting to be able to do something a little bit different and more in-depth that I'm super passionate about.
You went to culinary school.
I did.
Talk about how that informs your writing. Are you a better writer because you went for a career in this industry?
Yeah, I'd say for sure. Just the fact that I sort of fell into it by happenstance, going to culinary school, intending to obviously work in a kitchen or a bakery somewhere, and then just writing for the college newspaper on a whim and then just falling in love with it. It really informed, from the very beginning, my writing and my style. And especially with restaurants, a lot of the kitchen terminology is like a different language. So from the beginning, as I was getting into it, it became very, very helpful in informing all of that.
Do you find yourself being trained in the culinary arts? Do you find yourself understanding what a kitchen's trying to do more than, say, a freelance writer who might just be in arts and culture and got assigned to do a food review? Does that help you understand more of the mission of what a restaurant's trying to do?
For sure, for sure. I think it provides a sense of empathy that it's just really crucial in understanding what I'm talking about. It's hard. I just imagining people who go to journalism school with no experience or notion of the inner operations of kitchens, which are so manic and crazy and demanding, so much more beyond than what the public sees on the surface. So even though I didn't work extensively, like for years or anything, in kitchens, just the little bit in my internships and past experiences has been super helpful, and I appreciate it. I throughout the past decade, I've had a profound appreciation for chefs and owners and what they do. It's so complex.
What kept you from moving into that field? What was it that said, I'm going to be a writer instead of a chef?
I think it was just simply that I discovered I loved writing more than I loved cooking. So I loved talking about food and sharing that with the public more so than actually cooking
it,
which I still love and I've always loved. I just discovered conveniently that it was just more fun to share that with others in a different way.
Well, Matt, the book's called Unique Eats and Eateries of Chicago, and like I said, it's just under 100 restaurants. And it's amazing to think that maybe if you did this book 15, 20 years ago, that would be comprehensive. This is curated because there are a lot more than 100 restaurants in Chicago.
For sure.
And there are a lot of restaurants that didn't make this book. Talk about the process, the curatorial process of choosing what restaurants make it into Unique Eats and Eateries.
Yeah, well, that was by far the trickiest part, was narrowing it down, just because there are thousands of places that could have been in it. I tried to go for a good mix across the board. That means geographically, having different neighborhoods represented throughout the city, as far north as Andersonville and Rogers Park, and then as far south as like South Deering with Calumet Fisheries. And then a good mix of dining styles for bakeries, butcher shops, delis, to fine dining and tasting menus. So I just wanted something that would be truly and deeply representative of Chicago and its current status as such a culinary capital, and what's really lent itself to get to that point. And that's a mix of really old, established, family-run places that have been around for generations, and then even newer places that are just like a year old, all equally deserving, as with hundreds and hundreds of others.
It's everything from Manny's Deli, which everybody knows here in Chicago, to a newer place like Oriole, which with Chef in here not too long ago, but one of the best restaurants in Chicago.
Yeah, it's
but it's only been around for a year. When you talk about these restaurants and you want to tell their story, especially in this form where it is a descriptive, you know, you're telling the story of the restaurant, what do you have to do to prepare yourself to tell that story? Are you spending time at the restaurant? What's the process to put this story together?
Yeah, a lot of it is obviously dining there myself over the years, or more recently, or both. And then getting to know the chefs and pastry chefs, bakers, brewers, mixologists, and being able to tell their story by getting to know them and getting to understand what they're doing on a more profound, significant level. So it's just a matter of experience and time. Some of the newer places have only been, like Oriole, have only been to once. Mm-hmm. But still, like, just having one dinner there, it's profound. And in meeting with the chefs and talking with them over the phone, et cetera, it's abundantly clear that they deserve a place in a book like this about unique eats and what makes Chicago so special with its restaurants. And
let's talk about that, because you could do a unique eats and eateries of New York or Los Angeles or Las Vegas or Philadelphia. Chicago has, as you mentioned, become a culinary capital, and we continue to talk about that on this program. But what makes these places unique to Chicago? Meaning, what is it about the places that you feature in this book that you can't separate them from the city?
Well, there's a lot of that. My favorite thing about it, I think, is how it speaks to the neighborhood culture and patchwork of the city and how it's just comprised, and how you can go to an intersection in Humboldt Park versus just a stretch in Lincoln Park or Logan Square, where it's populated with these hip new bars and restaurants mm-hmm. all the time. So I love that the neighborhoods and the restaurants that make them what they are, I think, really speaks loudly to Chicago and makes it really special and unique. It's hard to go to other cities and feel that palpable significance. I travel a lot. A lot of cities have neighborhoods, and yeah. I mean, most of them. But I just feel like it's much more profound in Chicago, and you can get a sense of that. Everyone's very proud of their neighborhoods and where they are and ingratiating themselves in that. And that's my favorite thing to celebrate and talk about.
One of the things I've always wondered, I'm curious about the concept of when a restaurant opens up in a certain neighborhood, whether it be Humboldt Park or Edgewater or Logan Square, how often do they fit right in? And then, you know, like, we have some that'll say, oh, that feels like more like a River North restaurant in Humboldt Park, or that feels like a Rogers Park restaurant that's in Hyde Park. How often does that happen, where the restaurant misses the identity of the neighborhood that it's located in?
I think it happens pretty often.
Because I think of Logan Square is a good example of, like, that you walk in and you're like, wow, every storefront is a different type of restaurant. And it's hard sometimes to say, is this a Logan Square restaurant, or is it just there was an open vacancy and mm-hmm. the restaurant industry is like, I'm putting a nightclub there.
Yeah, yeah. I think, like, over time, certain neighborhoods become a lot more receptive to the hot, the new, the buzzy. Yeah. Like, Logan Square is at that point now. And you mentioned Diana Davila earlier.
Yeah, right.
I think a good example is prior to Mitsukaya, she had Cantina 1910 in Andersonville, which is a big, flashy restaurant that was super ambitious. And it didn't last. It was awesome. I loved it. But
it was different than the neighborhood.
Very different.
Right.
So I feel like it didn't fit
in
example, there very well. But explicitly, I remember dining there and thinking, like, this would do really well in the West Loop or Logan Square even at this point. So sometimes it places miss the mark, and maybe just the neighborhood at that time isn't right for it or quite ready. I think certain neighborhoods like Pilsen and Bridgeport are sort of getting more into that now as new concepts spread beyond the downtown core yeah. and then buzzier neighborhoods like Logan Square and Wicker Park. So it's kind of inevitable in the growing pains and so forth.
As a writer and the writer of this book, are Chicago close to saturation? I mean, we're at the point where it's like, wow, it's much different. I mean, we had Donnie Medea and Paul Kahn in here talking about how this is much different than when they started Blackbird 20-plus years. You know, you get the vibe that Chicago culinary artists are at a loss for how much bigger this scene can get.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, especially the past summer and the past year in general. All the openings are so incessant and nonstop, and I just wonder, I'm like, where is this going? Where is the real estate for this, for one thing? And just as it spreads out into different neighborhoods and takes over vacant storefronts, et cetera, it's pretty wild. I don't know. There must be, like, a ceiling or a bubble, but I don't know if we're quite there yet.
Yeah,
I'm sure at some point it might be
it's amazing to think about.
Enough,
yeah, right.
But, yeah, there,
but
it's
going,
crazy
right?
that there's still the audience and the crowds for it, because people line up. I'm still making reservations months out, so
it is absolutely. The book is called Unique Eats and Eateries of Chicago. Matt Kerouac is in studio tonight. If you're like me and I'm like, I'm not sure what I want to eat this night, so I just go to Google and put in best restaurants, and then I'm more confused about what I just pulled up. This book is perfect because it goes, it features the story of just under 100 Chicago restaurants, everything from, like we mentioned, Blackbird to Semitas Puebla to the Berghoff, which is still around, to Yoshi's Cafe in Boys Town. There's some great restaurants in here. The last question I have for you is what didn't make the cut? Like, you talked about editing it down. Is there one restaurant that's on the cutting room floor that you're like, oh, I wish I had one more page to put
in
here?
Well, many didn't make the cut. But one place that comes top of mind is The Gauge, I would say. I love that place.
Yeah,
it's
Michigan
been around
Avenue, yeah, right.
10 years now. And I feel like that played a big role in turning the downtown area, especially Michigan Avenue, into a like cool dining area for locals as opposed to just like a tourist swarm. Yeah. So that place is really awesome. And I'm bummed that that, in addition to many others, didn't fit in. But, you know, there's always...
Chapter two, or part two, right?
For sure, for sure.
The book is called Unique Eats and Eateries of Chicago. It showcases and focuses on just under 100 restaurants. Like I said, anything from, let's see, Donut Vault, Elizabeth, Fat Rice, it's great stuff, Furious Spoon, Girl and the Goat, and on and on, and Heaven on Seven. Matt Kerouac is the author. He is a Chicago-based food writer who's worked for several publications, including Time Out, Daily Candy, and Zagat. Matt, thanks for coming in and sharing the book and telling us about how it came to be.
My pleasure.
All right, coming up, Jason Stein will be here, the bass clarinetist. I have a jazz quartet. It's only a duo of the quartet in studio tonight. The Jason Stein Quartet, putting out a new album coming up here. I believe it's coming out on Friday. They'll be performing live in Studio 435 tonight. A little avant-garde jazz, a little bass clarinet. I'm excited about this. I feel like we've had a couple of jazz performers on, we had blues as well. But I was listening today. It was a soundtrack of my day. Well, Jason Stein, bass clarinetist. The bass clarinet was booming. I opened the windows. It's a lot of improvisation, jazz improvisation that was happening.
Your neighbors are saying, wasn't that guy listening to music from Molly on Friday? What's the story for this guy?
What's this guy? Who's this very intriguing worldly guy who also was screaming at the top of his lungs during the Bears game? You know, it's a funny joke in Incredible Kimmy Schmidt, and also it's just known that the only appropriate place to scream at the top of your lungs is on a roller coaster, right? That's like a lot of people. There's a great line in Kimmy Schmidt where the mom was like, you know what? It's the only place. Like, it was a great emotional moment where she's like, I love roller coasters because it's the only place I can scream at the top of my lungs that I need to scream. And I was like, you know, I don't make as much noise anywhere else in my life than I do than watching the Bears. Like, I realize, like, I'm sure it's annoying. But if you're in any bar, that's usually the case, you know, when people scream and yell when there's a touchdown. When Tariq Cohen scored the touchdown, he ran over the guy to get into the end zone. I was so loud. I mean, it was like, it's my roller coaster. I like, we have this little poof, like this little ball that, you know, is sold at the Crate and Barrel 2, the CB2. You know what I'm talking about? Like, it's kind of a knitted ball.
Yeah.
And then, like, after about a month, it sinks and sags into, now it's, I think it's like a square. But anyway, he scored a touchdown, and I yelled at the top of my lungs. My son was like, all right, here it comes. This is when Dad loses control. And I grabbed the poof, and I pulled it over my head like, yeah! And I was like, I've never done that. That's just not a thing you would do. And I'm doing it over a season opener, third quarter touchdown. Like, it wasn't even like, huh. I mean, it's just, yeah, like, I just had this moment that I was just emotionally had this moment.
Opening day. It's a big.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. If it's week eight.
Still doing
and
it?
And it's 0-7, and Tariq Cohen scores on a swing pass. I'll be like, ah, where's the poof?
Well, I think that, you know, it's opening day. It's against the team that was in the Super Bowl, you know, and they're playing well. You know what I mean?
I get it. But I think I get excited. It's the only place that I find myself in any form I don't scream and yell at concerts. I don't do a lot of screaming and yelling at home or in the office. You don't hear me on the air screaming. Yeah, it's not a thing. Cubs, Hawks, Bulls, they'll get me once in a while, but the Bears, a third and seventh stop on a 4-yard gain, it's not even a big play, will get me to audibly say, "Home run, yeah!" And I realize I probably know why my son doesn't really. I tried on yesterday, but then I also backed off. But he is not into it. He doesn't care about the Bears, right? And that's a bummer to me, just because I'm like, I wish I had a little mini me to make me feel better about myself and how I act as a grown man. But it was hilarious because I realized that early on in his like when he was a baby, we had him on the little chair on the coffee table, the kind of thing, like a little bouncer, you know. And it was the year after the Super Bowl, 2008, and I think it was week one or week two, and Cedric Benson broke one for the Cowboys, against the Cowboys. He broke one. He didn't score a touchdown, but he got like a 40-yard gain. And I did the same thing. I'm like,
traumatized.
Starts crying. Like a little baby who's, you know, maybe 2 months old.
Yeah.
Crying from it, like scared, startled.
Yeah.
And I'm
doesn't
like,
want any part of it from that.
So now
point
I think I know why he's not into it, because of my unconditional love for Cedric Benson.
That'll do it. That'll leave
hitched,
a scar.
Yeah,
that's
I hitched
leave
my
a
wagon
mark.
To Cedric Benson. Unfortunately, I made a choice. I'm like
the Bears.
I'm either gonna love Cedric Benson or my son. I got to make a choice right now. I think the best bet is Cedric Benson. I have a feeling he'll be with the Bears for a long time. So ridiculous. All right, coming up, we'll talk about Berwyn. We're going to be in Berwyn coming up here on Friday for the Oktoberfest celebration. We'll talk about that. And like I said, Studio 435, Jason Stein Quartet tonight. A little avant-garde jazz. All right. It's a download here at 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Like I said, coming up at Studio 435, live performance in our Allstate Showcase studio, Jason Stein Quartet. Jason Stein will be here with his bass clarinet. Get some live jazz tonight. That's what a night like this needs, right? A little early fall, some jazz, Chicago.
They're in there warming up in the green room right now. It just sounded really nice.
I can feel the upright bass through the wall.
Mm-hmm.
It's like boom, 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 boom.
That's it.
That's the vibe. That's what I feel right now. Reverberating. That or maybe my stomach's grumbling. One of the two.
From the wings or what kind of spread did you put out?
I didn't do a good job yesterday. I would say if you go back and look at the film of my snacks, didn't work out. I went to Do Right Donuts in the morning, and it was a little later, like 10-ish. And I got the egg sandwich there instead of the donuts because I'm on this kind of like trying to kick the eating hordes of chocolate for breakfast. Sure. I know, I'm unique. So anyway, I just kind of wasn't hungry. And I was watching the game, and then I just there was some chips to nosh on for just a second. That was it.
Yeah. It's weak.
I know, it was very weak. Did not go hard at all. I had some French onion dip in the fridge, didn't even pull it out. Had some cheese slices. Didn't pull it out.
Really?
I know. It was a quick game. I felt like it was kind of, before I blinked my eyes, it was in the fourth quarter. And then you can't mess with snacks when you get to the fourth quarter. You can barely pee at that point.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I
can save it for the week where they have the Sunday game. Don't they have a Sunday and a Thursday or something like that?
Right.
You know, so it's like two really quick back-to-back ones.
And you can keep the food. Can hold.
Yeah.
Right. That's coming up. I think they got the Packers on a Thursday night coming up here. And they're deadly four, the first quarter. Or Lovie Smith used to say it's quarters.
Yeah.
Right? The first quarter for the Bears season is not so good. Right now, the L.A. Chargers and the Denver Broncos are playing. And it made me think for a second, is Mante Tail still play? Is he still, remember the Notre Dame football player, the linebacker?
Yeah, the fishing guy?
Yeah. Does he play is he a San Diego Charger or L.A. Charger anymore?
He has no influence on my fantasy team, so I have no clue who's in the league.
I feel like I would know that. And he's had one of these, I think he's had very similar career as Kevin White, where he just keeps getting injured. Mm. you know, he never can stay on the field. But it's usually it's week one. Usually you'll see him for week one. And then about third quarter, you're like, Deo, something wrong with the knee. And then that's it. And then we're like, ah, oh, we were deprived of so many catfish fishing scams. Mm-hmm. Jokes that we could have
catfish,
made.
Catfish, I guess. I said fishing.
Yeah. We had, catfish, had a girlfriend that wasn't a girlfriend. Mm-hmm. That was one of the best stories in
college. Yeah, I believe Deadspin broke it.
Yeah. If you're not familiar, that look that one up. That's a good one. Yeah, so anyway, so yeah, I got to work on my food. I did not do well with the food.
It's okay, though. I was watching the I was watching on delay because I had a thing during the day, and kind of just the opposite of you. I was watching in bed next to my wife. 11 o'clock at night, she's sleeping, so I have it like on three, you know.
Are you fast forwarding through the each play, or do you watch it full?
I'm watching full.
You want to hear what the announcer says? You know, at a whisper.
Right. Yeah, and like some, you know, like I can't hear. I'm like, what did he say? I'm going back and forth.
That's
and
hilarious.
And I'm fast forwarding through the commercials and get back. And
right.
Then like you fast forward a little bit too fast, and they right. see you see something that might have looked interesting. You rewind. It's really, you know, Cletus, you know, the robot doing something. Like, oh, I didn't miss anything.
That's so funny too, because one of the big criticisms in my house is that my wife will start a game watching, and I feel like, oh, so this is a communal thing, you know, with my son and wife. But then you get to about the third quarter, it becomes nap time. After halftime becomes nap time.
Yeah.
So then it's the fourth quarter, and you're on your own island as a viewer. Now it's just you watching the game, and there'll be a 3rd and 8 or something, and something will happen, and you get into this screaming mode, and it wakes her up, and she's mad. What are you doing? What? And I'm like, this is not the ideal place to rest your head. Go somewhere else.
I mean, in her defense, normally in the fourth quarter, it's probably nap time, you know, for everybody involved.
The hard part I'm having is convincing the family that football is not just a Bears experience, but it's a day-long experience. You know, like my brother, and he doesn't have kids, and he lives out in California. And he and his wife, they're into football. So they start that day because it's earlier, 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
It runs all day, right?
It's so just like night game.
Yeah, the night game is like a five o'clock.
Yeah.
But they're just on lock. It's sports on lock all mm-hmm. day. And so for me, I get to the 3 o'clock, the game's over, and it becomes like, hey, you want to go look at the fall foliage? No.
Yeah.
I want to watch the Packers and the Seahawks.
Yeah.
Or something like that. So it's, but I really don't. I just don't want to – I mean, let's be honest. Like, there's no rooting moment where I'm like, oh, I got to have – oh, I can't wait to see what the Seahawks do.
Yeah.
I don't need to watch it. I don't need to. But it's – you get in the zone, and you're like, let's just see what the second half has to do here.
Yeah, I mean, before I got married, I would – you know, I'd wake up, turn on Sunday football, the countdown at 8 a.m., NFL Network, then at 10, you know, watching some other, watching the fantasy show for a while, then at 11, watching the Fox pregame with Strahan and Bradshaw, watching the full Bears, watching the Comcast 90-minute postgame, then getting into the, like, I would spend the entire day watching football.
And it's gross. There's something gross, not just about the fact that, you know, the game, but it's gross. Like, you get to a certain point where, like, it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and you're just like, I have not moved from this spot.
No.
Yeah, no, that's no
good.
Just
to go to the bathroom, and make some food. That right. was all day long. Not just like wearing the same t-shirt that you went to bed in.
it's so true. It's gross.
It's
a gross experience. Like, at least a baseball game, they don't do that in baseball. Like, it's not set up in a way that you're going to watch baseball all day long. Maybe it's one game, and that's a long time. It could be a 3-hour thing, but you're like, that's one game.
Yeah.
You're not watching the Cubs and the Reds and then being like, you know what, honey, the Mets and the Astros are about to start.
Yeah, exactly. No.
It's the same, like, when I think of Christmas Day when they do basketball back to back to back. I'm like, it's too much basketball.
Yeah.
I'm not sitting here all day watching, the second game, this is going to be great. The San Antonio Spurs against the Atlanta Hawks. What? So, yeah, football is its own thing, right? Well, I don't know how much – that's what I need. I need from the Bears to for them to stay competitive to, like, at least middle of the season. Because if they go down early, then, you know.
You're going to have to come up with a little bit. They're not even good. Why are you wasting your Sunday watching this terribleness?
Right. Well, my newest excuse is, hey, it's for work. Adam Johns is going to be on tomorrow. I got to be ready for it. I got to watch this game.
Well, that is true.
It is true.
And I feel somewhat the same way where, you know, I came home last night and wanted to watch it. So I'm, you know, prepared.
It's prep. It's prep. Babe, it's prep.
And because next week I'm going to blog.
Oh, you
are? WGN Radio.
They do that every Sunday. WGNRadio.com will do a live blog. You should check it out because we will all rotate through and get a chance to sort of comment in live moments on the Bears game.
And, you know, this is probably news to my wife right now as she's listening.
She's like, what? So, babe, I got to work it.
Yeah, so it kind of gives me an excuse to... You know, there's like, I got to do this from like 12 to 3.
Babe,
but after that,
I'm live blogging the Houston Texans Tennessee Titans game. I have to. It's my job.
It's so ridiculous. They tell you they're doing USC Texas for the college football game. They want me to blog.
Oh, babe.
Saturday night. It's weird, who knows?
I can't tell Todd, he emailed me specifically. It's like, you have to vlog this Mississippi State Texas A&M game that's on Fox 1. This Missouri Texas Tech, you gotta. I can't say no.
Right, no, it's ridiculous. The ramifications for what this means for the Northwestern team, you know, like you got to kind of tie it into WG.
Right. At least that's earlier in the day, right? Usually those games, so... All right, yeah, like we said, we're going to be in Berwyn this week, coming up on Friday, the next stop of the WGN Radio Hometown Voices Tour presented by Allstate. Join me, Pete, possibly Rob, we'll see about that, for live broadcast of The Download on this Friday at Laverne's Tavern in Berwyn from 7 to 10. No need to travel to Munich because Bavaria comes to Berwyn. With their annual Oktoberfest celebration. Come out and enjoy a special Oktoberfest-inspired menu. So wursts, a lot of wursts, knockwursts, bratwursts, maybe nachos. I don't know if they get how specific they're going to get. I always enjoy right now they have it going on in Lincoln Square, too. I saw a bunch of pictures on Instagram this weekend of people up enjoying the Oktoberfest celebration in Lincoln Square.
Yeah, me too. Beers.
When I used to live in that area, and this was about 22 years ago now, I lived in Lincoln Square before the Old Town School of Folk Music was there. It was just a closed library at that point, right? There was none of what is right now, and it's awesome to see the unbelievable development there. But if you know Lincoln Square, Garcia's was there, the Mexican restaurant, and the Greek restaurant was there, and the Hooten Bar and the Brauhaus. So anyway, the point would be that we moved up there, and I got an apartment above the Hansa Clipper at Lincoln, where it makes that turn, right? And me and my buddies got in there, and it was a three-bedroom apartment above the Hansa Clipper for $600.
Three-bedroom.
So when it all broke down, because I think once in a while, like we had like a guy stay there for a month, that wasn't a roommate.
Mm-hmm.
He just was hanging out, and he would throw in. I was paying it like $180 to stay there. The place was about, that was what it was worth, be honest with you. Like, we moved in. Just to date me, I was probably just turned 21 or right around 20 years old. We moved in the week of the Chicago heat wave, 1995. So when we moved in there, we're like, brand new house. We're like, no air conditioning. Oh, cool.
It's fine.
Open the window.
It'll be fine.
And there was a smell in that place that was like they had treated it in some form, you know, because we had moved in. Like, it just had like almost like a scented Raid.
Oh.
Right? That was the smell. And then it also, because it was so hot, below the place was a German sausage place on the corner there. And so coming up the pipes would be this German
wafting
of this German sausage. So that, like, kind of like that smell. That's what the smell was. That was permeated during the heat wave of August 1995. And so anyway, the reason I say this is that I remember the first couple weeks we were there, So we got there in August. We moved in August, right when it was going on. So we get to September. We get past the heat wave. We were working at Taste of Chicago. Remember that? We were handing out samples, free samples at the Taste of Chicago. That's what we would do. And it was the greatest place ever because you'd be like, hey, do you want a free sample of certs? Yeah, sure. Oh, yeah, what are you guys doing?
Oh yeah.
Well, we got this new place up in Lincoln Square. Oh, it's a little bit north. You love it. You should come by tonight. And it was like it would just be party time.
Yeah.
Right? So anyway, I remember one of the nights we had a party and I walked outside and, you know, got somebody a cab. We were leaving. I was standing and I sat down on the stairs right there on the Hansa Clipper, right in front of the house. And I'm like, nice night, you know, and randomly and out of nowhere, a guy in lederhosen just kind of walks by and the guy behind him, I'm like, oh, like the full costume. I mean, with the hat and mm-hmm, the green mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. the suspenders. I was like, where's that guy going? And who's wearing lederhosen? I'm just walking down the street in September. This is before I knew anything about the festival. And then, like, maybe like 2 minutes later, two more guys in lederhosen, one with like a tuba, like just walks by. And I was like, well, this is living in a German neighborhood. Like, this is.
You just thought it was their regular guys?
I think they were. Like, there was no, like, Oktoberfest yet. Like, that festival wasn't happening. They were just probably going to Brauhaus, and they probably were playing there or whatever, but they were just walking down Lincoln. And I just, like, moved in, like, maybe, you know, 3 weeks before. So I'm like, it's a nice this neighborhood no one's discovered but me, this 20-year-old kid, right? And it was just like, that was just normal to have guys in lederhosen just kind of walking up and down Lincoln Avenue. Now it's all for show. Now you put on your Instagram and your Twitter. You're faking it. It was authentic in 1996 for me. Anyway, so I'm excited to be a part of a traditional. This is the Oktoberfest in Berwyn is sort of cited to be the number one Oktoberfest celebration in the western suburbs. So there you go. So come on out to Berwyn.
I think perhaps you should wear some lederhosen.
If I had some, I would.
I think you can rent them. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't know where they've been when you rent them, though.
Yeah,
you really
true.
Want to get your own lederhosen. You don't want to be messing around with some used lederhosen.
My family's German, so when they dressed me in lederhosen, so I have a lot of lederhosen pictures as a kid. It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing. Like you're with like regular people, like with just in like t-shirts and like little pants, you know, like normal American clothes, and then I'm sitting there in lederhosen.
It was cute. I'm sure it was cute.
I mean, I'm sure it was.
Although probably like the third time it happened and your friends or your family are like, all right, enough of messing with Pete. Leave him be. We don't have to do this bit every time we get together. come out to Laverne's in Berwyn. That's where we're doing this. Visit the events page, WGNradio.com for details. The WGN Radio Hometown Voices Tour presented by Allstate, Chicago's own Good Hands. It's Friday night in Berwyn. And I'm excited because the mayor's going to come out. Charlie Meyerson, who lives right next door in Oak Park, is going to come out. We'll do a mini week in review. Also, I'm very excited about this. I just started looking at Berwyn. But I remember a couple years ago, I did a story about how they do a bungalow tour in Berwyn. Because the main architecture of Berwyn, Cicero, even Oak Park to some extent, is the bungalow. The old Chicago house that you could find that's a brick house. You know, everyone knows what a bungalow is, right? But that they do a tour in Berwyn to show you the examples of that architecture because it's so prevalent in that town. So we should talk about that, right? I feel like we should just get a live mic. Maybe Adam can hook us up with a live mic. We just walk around different people's bungalows and knock on the door. You mind if we tour your house?
Yeah, he'll do it.
Right?
Or he could set us up to do it.
That would be really a good bit to just walk into someone's random house and knock on the door and be like, hi, we're here to tour your historic home. As you can see here, this stairwell is historic. Get out of my house. So we'll do something like that. We got a lot of good stuff, right?
As long as there's pretzels and mustard.
Yeah, you're a pretzel mustard guy?
Oh, yeah.
I know. I feel like I remember one time I did I'm not a huge fan of German food. Like, I mean, what's not to love, right? But I remember I did a HGTV show. Forgot the name of it, but it was a show that I did where we were asked to, they called me, they found me, and they said, will you do, we want authentic Chicagoans to tell us where they eat. It was called We Live Here, right? And they did it in every city, and they did one in Chicago. And it was me and a couple other people who were like tastemakers. And so they asked, where do you want to go? And I'm like, well, I don't know. They're like, you want to go to Hot Dogs? I'm like, no. I love that place, yeah. But yeah, everyone knows that. But they're like, yeah, we heard it's good. Do you want to do Hot Dogs? Like they're really important. They really pushed Hot Dogs. Because it was like, so then you had to go up there with a crew, like during lunch rush. It was kind of, I was embarrassed. Cause
like
was
ahead like, of the line, like because,
yeah,
you know, that place would like
Doug
get
was
a
great
line.
Because he was just like, he, you know, he did the interview, but he wasn't like over, he wasn't like crazy about it. And then we did, I think it was Green Mill was the other one, which is a good place. And I'm like the Brow House up in Lincoln Square, right? And they're like, great. I'm like, that'll be fun. That's a great place. Let's go. Well, I didn't do a great enough job of communicating because we went to the Brow House to tape, and they set it all up, the producers and everything. But we went during the day because that's when they wanted to tape it.
Ooh.
And you go during the day at the Brow House. The best part about the Brow House is Saturday night,
yeah,
midnight with the huge steins, mm-hmm, and people in dressed to the nine. And they're like, they're all, you know, dancing on the floor. And you get this real vibe of like a cross-cultural and cross-generational kind of experience where there's young people, old, mm-hmm, people, a little bit. You go during the day, there's nothing. Like,
no.
Just, yeah. And so then they make it more like Justin's pick is the Brow House because he loves German food. And I'm like, it's not necessarily why I picked this place. Like, I was going for more of the entertainment,
yeah,
for, you know, at night. And so they brought out, like, plates of German food and made that the experience, like, while we were there. So they're like, ooh, this knockwurst is great, or this sauerkraut. And I'm like, it's not that great. It's just like, I get it. I love the Brow House.
Yeah.
I've given it so much business over time, but that's not why I'm giving them, you know, for the 2
yeah,
o'clock in the afternoon.
The food is part of the experience. You know, it's,
yeah,
not fine dining.
But they kind of push it like, you're going to love this taste. Taste this. And I'm like, maybe it's just a sausage. It's not that big of a deal. And I just always was like, oh, man, I got to do a better job of explaining myself.
Forever after, everybody would see, hey, there's that guy that loves German food.
Here's that guy that goes to the Brow House at 2 o'clock when it's closed and eats a bratwurst with the red sauerkraut. Yum, yum. So, yeah. So it's, yes, Friday, Berwyn, Hometown Voices.
Yeah.
That's so fun, man.
7 to 10?
7 to 10. I'm excited about it. I always love doing the Hometown
Berwyn's
Voices.
Awesome.
And Berwyn is awesome. So it's a place that I know a little bit about because I think I mentioned last week that I went out there a couple of years ago and I did I had a buddy who lived out there and we spent a week in his house writing a script we're working on. So we ended up like just living out of Berwyn for a couple of weeks.
It's really close to the Burlington, I believe, the Burlington Northern, because this place is a craft beer bar.
Oh.
So I'm excited to sample
nice.
Some of the Laverne's specialties.
And get on the train.
And then get on the train, yeah, if I could find it.
312 says the Brow House closed. Is that true? I was in the Brow House in the summer, in August, July.
I think there was a rumor that it was closing, and
right, that was a big thing.
Yeah,
but
I don't know if
they
had
actually
officially
pulled it.
Did.
I'm gonna Google it.
When we go to Jeans
no,
a lot now, which is you know, the sausage emporium that has the nice roof deck. So I don't know if we get to the Brow House too often.
Well, the Brow House says I looked at their site and they got upcoming events, so they still have things like the Fat Tuesday Crazy Hat Night Mardi Gras party on February 28th. So you can tell they're really updated.
2018.
2016, I think. I'm not even sure. Oh, I love it. But that's just what you expect from the Brow House website. I mean, someone got like the bug where they're like, you know, we should put these events on the website. Good idea. Let's start with Fat Tuesday, and then we're going to do it every week. I got done with Fat Tuesday. I'm like, you know what? I forgot the password. And this WordPress needs an update. So we're just going to, you know what? Why don't we just do a rotating flash thing at the top that just keeps showing the building and then just keep everything else the same?
I mean, nothing says Mardi Gras and Fat Tuesday like some sauerkraut.
Nothing. All right, so we'll be at Berwyn coming up here on Friday at Laverne's in Berwyn. I'm excited for that from the Hometown Voices. All right, coming up, Studio 435. We got some jazz in studio in our All-State Showcase studio, so stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and it's time for Studio 435, our weekly segment that brings you the best live music Chicago has to offer in our Allstate Showcase studio right here on beautiful Michigan Avenue. Tonight, we go avant-garde with the jazz bass clarinetist Jason Stein. Stein leads the Jason Stein Quartet, who's about to put out their album on Delmark Records. It's called Lucille. It's going to be available this Friday. Stein's been a fixture on Chicago's jazz scene. He's produced or played on over 30 albums. He's going to be doing a record release show for the new album on September 30th at Constellation, right there, 3111 Northwestern. Tonight, he's here along with his bass clarinet, of course, and his bass player, Joshua Abrams. So why don't we go right to the music? Here is a track, Darn That Dream. Jason Stein, take it away, guys. Thank you. There we go. All right. In studio 435 tonight, Jason Stein and Joshua Abrams. Jason Stein on the bass clarinet, Joshua Abrams on the upright bass. They are part of the Jason Stein Quartet. We'll be playing at Constellation on September 30th, 3111 Northwestern Avenue. They also have a brand new album coming out called Lucille, which will be out this Friday. All right, we're going to talk with Jason Stein coming up here in Studio 435 and also hear some more jazz music tonight. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in Studio 435. Jason Stein, the Jason Stein Quartet, putting out their album on Delmark Records this Friday called Lucille. They also have a show, a record release show, coming up on September 30th at Constellation on Northside, 3111 Northwestern. Jason Stein in studio tonight, along with his bass player, Joshua Abrams. Jason, nice to meet you. Thanks for playing with us. That was great.
Pleasure. Thanks a lot. Yeah,
that was so fun, here. Man. You know, you usually play in a quartet. For you to strip down and just do two instruments, is that easy to do as a jazz musician to be able to – is it easier than say, other disciplines of music?
Yeah, you know, I think as a jazz musician, you wind up playing in all different kinds of settings. I've played solo shows where it's just me for an hour, and duo stuff. Yeah, and any number of different people. So yeah, it's pretty comfortable.
I know. I was listening to some of your stuff today that was solo, and yeah. It just became the backdrop. It was really fun because I had the windows open. It was playing, so it became almost the soundtrack for a nice fall Chicago day, which is great.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so let's talk about the bass clarinet. I'm fascinated by this because just doing a little bit of reading today, it's not an instrument that usually you'll find in a jazz band.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about how you got involved, and then we'll talk a little bit about the instrument.
Yeah, absolutely. I started playing what's generally late for most professional jazz musicians. I came to the instrument in my early 20s, and I knew I wanted to play a horn. I played guitar for a long time and learned how to play music playing guitar. And so many people play saxophone. I thought I'll just mess around with this other instrument called the bass clarinet. The probably the most famous musician who deals with that instrument's name is Eric Dolphy.
Yeah,
he played a lot in the '60s. He did wonders with the instrument and really kind of put it on the map for people. Although Duke Ellington used the bass clarinet a fair amount in his orchestra before that. And yeah, I think of it kind of like a cousin to the saxophone. It shares a lot of similar qualities with the saxophone and can deal with the music, I think, in similar ways. But it's a different sound.
It is a different sound. It is a sound. When I listened to you guys playing here, I felt like it was right at home, though. Like, and it might be that throwback to the Duke Ellington, the band, and the idea that we've heard that sound before. Why aren't more jazz musicians popularizing that? Why didn't we hear that instrument, the bass clarinet, in other standards? I mean, you mentioned Eric Dolphy, but the others in the '60s and '70s.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that kind of is. I have to get a little scientific.
I love it. Let's do it.
Okay.
It's okay.
The clarinet is it's a cylinder, and the saxophone is a cone, just the shape of the instrument. And because of that, the saxophone winds up projecting in a really different way than the clarinet does.
Okay.
The saxophone is made to play outside in marching bands. It's made to be very loud and to be able to move around on it quite quickly. The bass clarinet especially was made more as a color instrument to add sound to what was already kind of a central melody happening. And so there's challenges to play with drums, to be able to play loud enough, to be able to play clearly enough to make sense in a lot of jazz contexts.
Right.
And a lot of saxophone players do pick up the bass clarinet as an experiment, and then just from people I've spoken to, wind up dropping it because it's kind of a challenge to play in the context that come up.
To be able to perform it live with a jazz band is difficult.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's fair.
You know, is it an instrument that you'd find in symphonies? I mean, you have the woodwinds and the other instruments that will show up there as well?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, there's usually someone who plays both clarinet and bass clarinet, and there will be some pieces that will call for bass clarinet in certain parts.
Does it make it, I mean, do you automatically, by playing the bass clarinet, do you find yourself limiting the kind of jazz you can play? I mean, obviously with the bass notes and all that, but with the clarinet and not being able to adapt necessarily to the standards that never use that instrument, does it make it more difficult to play standard jazz? Or
think,
can you adapt?
Yeah, I would say it might make it more difficult. I'm not sure because I played it for so long and I'm so used to it. And I sort of took it on as I like the challenge to try and make it work in different contexts. I work quite a bit, so it works in the things that I do,
yeah,
I guess, because stuff comes up. But it's a pretty flexible instrument. I think it can make sense in a lot of different spots. And I enjoy the challenge, I guess, of making that happen.
Jason Stein in studio with us tonight. Jason Stein Quartet just putting out an album this Friday in Delmark called Lucille. They got a show coming up as well at Constellation on September 30th. You know, I mentioned it a couple times. I mentioned in the intro the word avant-garde, which is it's a genre of jazz music. Do you find yourself categorized that way? Do you like to say that you're an avant-garde jazz musician?
I don't mind the categorization at all. I tend to not use that word for myself.
It's a strange word to apply to a music genre.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's one of those things. That word maybe has certain meanings to me. I have no idea what it might mean to other people. I think a lot based on associations, and I don't know what music people have in their heads of what represents what.
Right.
The song we just played, "Darn That Dream," is a very old jazz standard. Nothing really avant-garde about it, and I really enjoy playing music that wouldn't necessarily be considered avant-garde. The records that I've made, I guess, have tended to be more in that direction.
Well, I mean, when we say avant-garde music, is that experimental music? I mean, in the form, yeah.
Not me.
Yeah.
I guess I think of it as a tradition. You know, in jazz, there's a sort of legacy that I think sort of started with John Coltrane and Ornette Coleman, Archie Shepp, Pharoah Sanders, Cecil Taylor, just people that took the music and pushed it into sounds that were more unfamiliar,
right?
Playing songs that didn't as much deal with harmonies or song forms, just more of an open interpretation of how to deal with music.
Well, I was going to ask that question because when it comes to jazz music, how much at its core is it experimental? You know, because there are different subcategories and genres in jazz, and Chicago is a tremendous home for AACM, for mm-hmm. different styles of jazz music that you wouldn't necessarily find in a big band.
Absolutely.
Right? But, yeah. I mean, when you talk about let's talk just about experimentation. Like, does jazz, there's a part of it in improvisation, playing standards, the stuff that we know from the biggest big bands that have ever played. But that word and that style, it means something to a lot of different people.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, I think that jazz at its heart and historically is experimental regardless of the style of jazz music you're dealing with. I mean, just it's an improvisational music, and improvisation by nature is somewhat experimental. I mean, I guess you could work out everything you're going to play beforehand and then ostensibly be improvising, but be playing things that are planned out. But for the most part, I think people are really trying to make things up when they're playing. And the subcategory that then that improvisation fits into, I think, is open to interpretation.
Right.
But at its heart, I do think it's
I guess that's really at its heart. I mean, the idea that improvisation is going to be some level of experimentation every time, but there are some that are conservative with it that'll stay within the range and the notes that they know, and that's where they go.
Yeah.
But what really will encapsulate or, you know, make someone fall more into an experimental jazz category is how far you go with that improvisation, how out into one area you'll go that maybe musicians haven't gone before.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is just dealing with rhythm, how there's ways of playing that there's not really a beat that you could necessarily tap your foot to, and that might seem kind of foreign or uncomfortable to some people, or it might seem really exciting and interesting to other people. It's the nature of art,
yeah.
I think. I mean, I guess a reasonable comparison could be like with painting. You know, you can paint a tree and someone can look at it and say, oh, yeah, that's clearly a tree. There's a clear melody and there's clear rhythm and it's obvious. Or you could paint something and I could say this is a tree and you could have no idea.
As a bass clarinetist, is there a style you prefer? I mean, are you somebody who in your recordings, I mean, stuff that I was listening to today, I mean, you are going off in an area where you are pushing boundaries on timing or pushing boundary on arrangement.
For sure.
Is that more comfortable for you than sort of what we just heard, the standard where that's, that, you know, you kind of know where you guys are at?
I wouldn't say it's more comfortable. I think I feel like I have more to say in that music, it feels more original and more mine, where it's I have more to express
right.
in that. But in terms of comfort or enjoyment, I really do enjoy the whole spectrum.
Well, I mean, it does help. Playing the bass clarinet does help in the sense that you can go away from standards because there's no bass clarinet necessarily in those tracks. But yeah. but it gives you an opportunity to really push the instrument. As you become more and more evolved as a professional bass clarinetist, do you learn new things about the instrument? As you try to experiment with it and push it in ways that you haven't before, is there a point of discovery with an instrument like this?
Very much so. I sort of think of that as the job. You know, I practice every day, and I really do try and learn new things as much as I can. Yeah, for sure. Whether it's learning new tunes, new approaches, new sounds, new ideas, melodically, rhythmically, whatever. Yeah, for sure.
Well, coming up, we're going to hear some more from Jason Stein Quartet. Joshua Abrams on the bass is in the studio, but more of a duo than a quartet tonight. But they got an album coming out called Lucille, which is out this Friday. They are our guest tonight at Studio 435. Like I said, after Rob's news, we will hear them live for some more Studio 435 here on The Download, so stay with us. All right, right now, let's do this. Let's get an update on tonight's news. Thanks, Rob. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's Studio 435 time. This is our weekly segment, bringing you the best live music Chicago has to offer right here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue in our Tribune Tower Studios. Tonight, jazz bass clarinet with Jason Stein. The Jason Stein Quartet has a new album coming out on Delmark. It's called Lucille. It's coming out on Friday. They also got a release party September 30th at Constellation, 3111 Northwestern Avenue. Tonight, Jason Stein's here with his bass clarinet, and Joshua Abrams is on bass, and they're ready to perform another track tonight. What are we going to hear right now, Jason?
This is a composition by Oliver Lake called Crooked Blues.
Crooked Blues, take it away.
Thank you.
Yeah, there we go. Jason Stein duo. The half of the quartet is here in Studio 435 tonight. Jason Stein, Joshua Abrams on the upright bass. Jason, why don't you come back up to the microphone? They have an album coming out on this Friday called Lucille, and they also have a record release show coming up at the end of the month, September 30th at Constellation, 3111 North Western Avenue. 8:30, start on that. Like I said, Jason Stein, Joshua Abrams tonight performing. We've got one more song we'll play before the end of the hour. You know, again, another track that seemed pretty standard in its way. I mean, there's a lot of flexibility with this instrument.
For sure. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know, for you, being a guy who started with this instrument late, does that mean you started with jazz late, or were you a jazz guitar player? Like, look, talk about your relationship with the music.
Yeah, yeah, I've been playing jazz on guitar for quite a while, for a number of years. I started doing that in high school, and I was really interested in it, but I just never really felt a sense of fluidity that I imagined was necessary to really pursue it as a professional type thing. At that age, I thought I wanted to be a writer. And then when I came to this instrument, it really just felt pretty natural from the start. And I sort of surprised myself that I really quickly wanted to pursue it.
Let me ask you an emotional question just about the sound of Please. The horn. You know, just the, you know, as you going from a guitar to the horn, and you talk about that fluidity. What is it about that sound of the horn that works in jazz music?
Oh, man. The easiest answer is I really don't know. I mean, it's more, I think, an intuitive experience for me. It just sounds right, and I leave it at that. I guess I could intellectually explore it. I think that maybe the best answer would be its relationship with the saxophone, and that is a pretty stereotypical yeah. instrument that we've all heard. And
my question goes even beyond the bass clarinet. I mean, it's okay. amazing to me when you think of jazz music that the horn that, you know, really has found its way to be a symphony instrument, mm-hmm. an instrument that for long classical music and has just, I mean, it is a perfect, I mean, there is, it's synonymous with jazz music. It is, I mean, there, it almost feels, there's lots of jazz music out there, but that sound of that horn sound, mm-hmm. it just, I don't know, there's like some beauty in the way that it interacts with the other music, with the bass and other, what do you think that is? What do you think jazz, where do you think, why do you think that works so well?
Rhythm. I think it's rhythm. I think it has to do with articulation, how a note begins and ends using your breath and your tongue and your lungs and your mouth. And that there's something pretty similar to speaking that's really intuitive.
Yeah, right.
And that works.
You know, for you to be a guy who you grew up in New York, right?
I did.
And came to Chicago. Chicago's got a long history with jazz music. I mean, for there's sure. there's so many great jazz musicians who've come through here. Jazz and blues are history. Do you feel that? I mean, being a Chicago musician who now calls this town your home, and do you feel the history of jazz music?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's a number of Chicago musicians that I know and love and have for a long time. Yeah.
I mean, what is Chicago's sound? If I'm not familiar, I mean, I'm familiar with jazz, but the idea, like, you'll think of New York, and I think of Blue Note, and, you know, maybe a little Coltrane, Miles Davis even. You think of the West Coast, you kind of get a chill vibe. Mm-hmm. What's Chicago's sound when it comes to jazz music?
I think that also is kind of open to interpretation. I mean, I think, I guess I think of, like, a kind of hard-edged, biting, fast people like there's a long list, but yeah, just kind of edgy.
And kind there is of, something to tough. Be said. I mean, you know, where you find yourself, you know, straddling the standards, as we heard, and mm-hmm. the experimental music. Chicago's been there for a long time. Talk about the independent scene here when it comes to experimental jazz music, because you can make an argument that a lot of, I mean, you talked about Coltrane and some of the other places where are people who have really pushed the boundaries, but the music that's come out of Chicago, when you think of I don't even know, Khalil El-Zabar and mm-hmm. And Von Freeman was another, but musicians who have really sort of put taken the discipline and the genre and pushed it in different places. Chicago's had a number of experimental jazz musicians.
For sure. Yeah, I mean the AACM is probably the easiest group to point to. Roscoe Mitchell, who was actually just here for the Jazz Festival and played an incredible set. But they are one of the most important groups ever to play. They obviously came out of Chicago.
This is the Artists and for the Advancement of Creative Music, right? Is that AACM? Did I get it right? Close? Associations in there too.
yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, and the Art Ensemble Chicago.
Right.
Von Freeman, like you said, is super important. Fred Anderson, who passed a few years ago, is an extremely important voice in Chicago.
Is that music, and I remember this, I had a chance when I was a young kid to be, when I was in production, to at least be around some great jazz media greats, Dick Buckley and Larry Smith and mm-hmm. some others. And there was always, I picked up the I guess the storyline that there was this division in jazz between experimental or alternative jazz, mm-hmm. where you saw a lot of people from Chicago, AACM, and what record companies were putting out, meaning mm-hmm. the standards from New York, the Blue Notes and what have you, and one being commercially viable and one not. I mean, is there still a division in the jazz world between the musicians who play the standards and the musicians who are more experimental?
Yeah, I would say that there is. I don't know that it falls along commercial viability because none of it's commercially viable,
right?
Regardless of label or style or whatever. The way that I think of that has more to do with dancing. Jazz initially in the 20s and 30s was dance music, and there would be packed houses dancing to big bands, Duke Ellington, Fletcher Henderson, Count Basie. And then what's called bebop music kind of came in and was faster and really virtuosically impressive, but not as appealing to dance to for a lot of people. Mm. And it kind of intellectualized the music, I guess, to some extent. And that is not insulting towards that music at all. It's some of my favorite music. But I think it kind of became more art music and abstract and expressive and, to me, very, very exciting. But less something that was going to pack houses for dancing or anything else.
You know, let me ask, I'm fascinated just having you here, and I don't know if you have the answer to this, but I think about other disciplines of music, and it's been well documented that jazz and blues have become less and less commercially viable over the years, right? Mm-hmm. There used to be a time when you could jazz, you know, put out a Miles Davis record and it was the biggest record in the country. Sure. That's not the case anymore. And I think about hip hop, and I think about rock music, and you see more and more stories of artists doing it themselves mm-hmm. or independently using the tools that are now available on the internet. They don't need to go through record companies. Yeah. Is that a viable alternative for jazz music? I mean, could jazz music sustain itself and find a community online that goes away from the old traditional jazz labels being the sort of gatekeepers and find an audience that's not necessarily through those companies?
Yeah, that is definitely happening in parallel to what you said, but just on a much smaller scale. But yeah, for sure, there's so much room for direct communication with music and with people that might be interested in what you're doing.
Right.
I mean, even dealing with labels, it's just a very small market and a small thing where I don't think it's even really that comparable to the way it was 40 or 50 years ago.
Right.
You know,
I've had a couple of blues musicians and jazz musicians in studio, and we talked about how the comparisons between the American market and the European market, and the mm-hmm. fact that jazz and blues still is a market, meaning a blues musician can go over and play in Germany and they're a pound crowd and people want to buy their stuff, and they come back to Chicago and they're like, we don't really want to deal with blues music. Is it the same with jazz? I mean, does jazz still have a hold in European cities?
Yeah, I would say so. My experience of that has been that, there's quite a big audience in a lot of cities in Europe. There's a big audience in America and a lot of cities, too. I think the biggest difference is that there's still a lot more government funding for concert series to be put on, where I might go with the band to Copenhagen and we can play for 200 people. That we could play for 200 people here also, but there we would make a lot more money because it's not just based on ticket sales.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Jason Stein in studio, Jason Stein Quartet. Fixture here in the Chicago jazz scene. They are putting out a new album on Del Mar called Lucille. It's out Friday. They got a record release show at Constellation, 3111 Northwestern Avenue, coming up at the end of the month, September 30th. We'll do this. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll get our last track live in Studio 435. Jason Stein and Jason Stein Quartet. Stay with us. It's Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Studio 435 right now. Our weekly segment bringing you the best live music Chicago has. Our Allstate Showcase Studio tonight. Jason Stein, Jason Stein Duo. It's a quartet. We got two in studio, Jason Stein and Joshua Abrams. They have a new album coming out on Del Mar this Friday called Lucille, and they will be at Constellation at the end of the month, September 30th, for the record release show. Let's hear one more track from Jason. Jason, what's this one here?
This tune is called Marshmallow.
All right, fantastic. Marshmallow, take it away. Thank you. Yeah, there we go. Jason Stein, Jason Stein Quartet, the duo tonight. Jason Stein and Joshua Abrams. The quartet has their album coming out on Delmark Records called Lucille. It's out this Friday, and they're going to be doing their record release show at Constellation coming up at the end of the month, September 30th. Jason Stein, Joshua Abrams. Jason, thanks so much for playing tonight and being our guest at Studio 435.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
That's going to do it tonight for The Download. Coming up tomorrow night, Eve Ewing, great writer, poet, commentator, my guest at the big table. Also, we will, on A Download in Chicago Business, we will have the CEO of Portillo's. We'll talk hot dogs. So that's coming up tomorrow night on The Download. Coming up tonight, Patty Vasquez, Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. Patty's here.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm really good. Great music tonight.
I know, right? Weren't they great?
They were amazing. And how lucky are we to have Bob Ferguson?
I know,
making
right?
sure our band sound is good.
He's
on
so
the
good.
Air.
He's so good.
We have Music Monday, too. And we're going to talk about some of our friends who were on the ground in Florida. Do you have a plan in case there's a natural disaster?
Such a great question. I talked about it with my son this week. I was like, you know, next weekend, let's go to Home Depot, get mm-hmm. some duct tape.
Yeah, and I mean, and the other thing, too, is that, you know, as we think about 9/11, I mean, you know, it's yeah. one of those things where you have to be prepared. You don't know. Like, it's...
You don't. I mean, you got to get a... There's a... It was interesting because Disney Channel has a PSA they run with one of the stars of their shows.
Yeah.
And they're like, hey, do you have a plan for when, if there's a disaster? Hey, it's Cody from Cody and... And you're like... So there is,
how does Cody have a plan and we don't?
Cody's got a plan. And I was like, wow, they're really thinking about this. This yeah. is a national broadcast. I'm like, yeah, I should probably get it together.
It's part of our kids' reality now, isn't
I know,
that weird?
Right? Yeah. And, yeah, and so much to do this weekend.
Yeah, lots. I know. Didn't mean to freak you out right before you leave.
No,
so
it's
sorry
good.
About
it's
that.
Good. Here it's go. A good reminder. It's a good reminder.
Freak out.